Blog Talk Radio.
This is the AM Byte interview, and with us we have the pleasure of being joined by Robert W. Sullivan to discuss his book, The Royal Arch of Enoch, The Impact of Masonic Ritual, Philosophy, and Symbolism. How are you doing today, Robert?
I am very well. Thank you, Miguel, and thank you for having me on your show.
The pleasure is all ours. So tell us a little bit about yourself, specifically your journey to writing The Royal Arch of Enoch.
Oh, it'd be my pleasure. This book started for me 20 years ago. I didn't start writing it 20 years ago, but the journey for me started 20 years ago when I was an associate student at Oxford University. I was at St. Catherine's College. My alma mater was Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania, and I was accepted to become an associate student at St. Cat's for the year at Oxford. When I got over there, this would have been in September of 1992, and I was there till around June of 1993, I was studying history, philosophy. I was reading a lot of the books that a lot of my teachers at Gettysburg were relying on. And what became apparent to me when I was over there, and, you know, this was 1992. I was only 20, 21 years old at the time. I wasn't a Mason or anything like that. But what really sort of got me interested in this subject matter was the concept of the Hermetic tradition, if you will, coming out of the Renaissance into the Enlightenment, ultimately being carried on in secret societies such as Freemasonry, Odd Fellows, in the United States. And it was really the impact of this tradition on material culture, both politically, socially, and even economically, and even religiously. And I just became very fascinated with this. I was introduced when I was over there to people, authors that I had never heard of over here. Mainly the main one was Frances Yates. She was a English author who wrote extensively about, you know, in the influence of like Rosicrucianism, Freemasonry, the writings of people like Giordano Bruno, the Jesuit priest Athanasius Kircher. And I just really became impressed with this. And it started this sort of ball rolling where I just started researching more and more about Freemasonry and about how the values contained within Freemasonry, both Blue Lodge and ultimately the higher degrees, which is what my book's about, just how they impacted society and, you know, and history. And it was sort of almost like it wasn't anything negative, but it was almost like the major, you know, quote unquote mainstream historians were sort of like stepping away from this material. It was one thing that Yates just drove her nuts, that, you know, one of the reasons that motivated her in her writing her books were that the mainstream historians were kind of ignoring or sidestepping this material. And ultimately, when I came back to the States, I graduated Gettysburg. I went to law school in the late 1990s. And again, you know, it was, you know, it wasn't like I started really, you know, I was doing the research, but it wasn't, you know, I mean, I had a life to live too. I got introduced to the teachings, the books of people like Albert Pike, Manly Palmer Hall, Albert Mackey. And as I was going to law school, the opportunity presented itself for me to join a Masonic lodge here in Baltimore. I took the opportunity. I became a Freemason, a third-degree Freemason, in Amicable John's Lodge number 25. That's here in Baltimore. I went to law school. Shortly before graduating law school, I actually became a 32nd degree here in the Valley of Baltimore, Grand Orient or Orient of Maryland. And it really was in the late 90s and the early 2000s with the advent of the Internet that when I got on the Internet, I didn't have a page or anything, but I began to read, find people who were interested in the same subject matter. And I remember thinking to myself one day, you know, gee, wouldn't this be great if one day I could have one of these web pages and start presenting the research that I was doing on this and, you know, get interaction from people. And it wasn't until the mid-2000s, probably around 2005, 2006, and, you know, bear in mind, this is before Twitter, Facebook, it was with the social networking page called MySpace. I created one of these pages, and I basically turned it into this Masonic research page, if you will. I was posting photo galleries relating to this research, relating to sort of the astrological, mystical elements of Freemasonry. Obviously, I was a Mason by that time. You know, I was well-versed with people like Hall, you know, Pike, Mackey, and I posted photo galleries on this. It was completely open to the public. I began posting blogs about it. I began talking about the symbolism of Masonic, you know, iconography in popular movies. And this just, the page just went absolutely skyrocket. I mean, I was getting hits from it, you know, all over the place. And it wasn't until around 2005, 2006, right around the same time, a friend of mine approached me who was also a Mason, and he had seen the page and said, you know, Rob, what you're doing here with this page is really great. You know, and I commend you for it. He said, but, you know, rather than, you know, kind of fooling around with this, why don't you commit yourself to a book about it? And that was something I had originally planned anyway, going all the way back to my Oxford days. And sort of, you know, like you see in a cartoon, the light bulb went off over my head. And probably starting around, I don't know, late 2006, I really began putting pen to paper. And it wasn't until 2008, 2009, when I really began, you know, writing on this thing nonstop and just committing myself to doing, you know, the research and just staying up, you know, sitting in my computer 14 hours at a time doing this book. And it ultimately was completed in the summer of 2011. I copyrighted it in August of 2011, and the book was published as it is today a year later.
So, Robert, tell us about the Book of Enoch, which you write extensively about. And it may surprise people that Enoch is very influential to Freemasonry. Why is that?
Yes, you are correct. The Book of Enoch, it ties into Masonic lore. The Royal Arch degree, there's one of them that's actually named after Enoch. And to understand this, you have to understand a little bit about Enoch, who he is, what he represents, and his own book. Enoch appears in the book of Genesis at 524, and he's one of two people in the Bible to never die a physical death. The prophet Elijah is the other. And Enoch is taken up into heaven and in corporeal form. Basically, he doesn't enter as a spirit, he enters as a human being. And when he gets into heaven, he sees some pretty strange things. Maybe not strange, but some things that are out of the norm when you deal with Orthodox Christianity. He gets up there. He basically is told that the tree of life that Adam and Eve bit from is the Hebrew Kabbalah. The apple that Eve bit from is symbolically one of the Sephirot of Hebrew Kabbalah. He's introduced to a group of angels known as the Watchers, who are looking over this group of another group of angels called the fallen, basically. They're a group of fallen angels that have been cast out. And, you know, the Watchers keep an eye on them. Sometimes the cast out angels are actually called the Watchers also. And what he learns is when he's in heaven, and he serves as sort of like an intermediary. The word lawyer is not a good word, but he serves as an intermediary between these fallen angels, God, and these archangels. And this is documented in his book called the Book of Enoch. It dates from around 300 BCE. And in it, Enoch is describing what he sees in heaven, basically. The book is lost from history from around two common era to around the late 1700s, when a Freemason named James Bruce is traveling Ethiopia, and he comes across some copies of it, and he returns to Europe with them. The copies are deposited in the basement of the Bodleian Library at Oxford University. They sit there until 1821, when they're finally translated into English. Now, what my book documents is that the high degrees of Freemasonry, which are coming out of France in the 1730s, and this one degree in particular called the Royal Arch of Enoch, is actually documenting elements of the Book of Enoch, which should not be happening because the book should have been off the history pages. I propose in my book that someone in Europe must have seen a copy of this thing, or there was a copy in Europe floating around prior to Bruce coming back with it. The most likely candidate would have been a guy named Andrew Michael the Chevalier Ramsay. But why it's important within Freemasonry is it is within this degree, and this is reflective of the Book of Enoch, it's where the candidate, it's the recovery of what's called the Tetragrammaton, which is the name of God. And it's through this recovery of this that all restoration of pre-flood of Noah knowledge is restored to mankind. And I should point out what I'm saying is this gets into Masonic lore, and you kind of ask me why is this important. Within Masonic lore, when Enoch returns to Earth with this knowledge that he's gleaned from being in heaven, he catches wind that the flood of Noah is coming and that mankind's going to be eradicated. What he does is he takes this knowledge, inscribes it on two pillars, one containing the seven liberal arts, one containing mathematical knowledge, and the name of God, the Tetragrammaton, buries it in this underground vault. The flood of Noah comes, the vault survives, and it's in with Masonic lore that it's the Masons, through these two people named Pythagoras and Hermes Trismegistus, that discover this vault, restore the knowledge to mankind, and in Masonic ritual, the Masons actually discover this vault themselves during the building of the Second Temple. And it ties into the high degree and this mythology of Masonry as the keepers of this lost yet legitimate knowledge.
And doesn't the name Enoch in Hebrew mean initiated? Isn't that symbolically something important?
That's correct. The name Enoch in Hebrew means the initiated, and what that derives from is his learning this, you know, again, it reflects to a Masonic candidate being a member of the initiated. And what it does is it reflects that the supreme, you know, esoteric knowledge that Enoch got while being in heaven, seeing all these things, which God ultimately tried to eradicate with the flood of Noah, this ties into sort of the anti-Masonry element, that the Masons are the preservers of this wisdom, this knowledge that God was trying to eradicate. And through the possession of this loss of God and the ability to restore this lost knowledge, this is the crux, if you will, of anti-Masonry of the 1820s that almost wipes Freemasonry out in the United States.
And beyond Enoch, why are solar deities and symbolism, which are replete in your book, so relevant to Freemasonry?
It ties into Enoch. Enoch, if you read Genesis, when you get into concepts of these solar deities, it's reflected, the solar symbology is replete in Freemasonry. Enoch in the book of Genesis told lived for 365 years. That's an obvious solar reference. In the Royal Arch degree, the recovery of the Tetragrammaton is made possible through the sun rays penetrating this underground arch or this underground vault. Within Blue Lodge Freemasonry, the actual third degree ritual is basically a retelling of the Osirian cycle from Egypt, where, you know, Osiris is killed, Isis, his wife, possesses the secret name of God, produces magic to resurrect Osiris, and the magic she produces by holding the secret name of an Egyptian sun god named Amun-Re or Ra. This is symbolically duplicated, if you will, in Blue Lodge Freemasonry, where in the third degree, the candidate portrays Hiram Abiff, who is a solar, you know, icon or stand-in, if you will. He is killed and is ultimately searched and found, his body is found by 12 Felocrats. The 12 Felocrats are, of course, the 12 houses of the Zodiac who are going looking for their lost solar ruler, if you will. Hiram Abiff is resurrected on the third try. They try to resurrect him first by the grip of a an entered apprentice. That doesn't work. Then they try Felocraft. That doesn't work. Then they try the grip of a master mason, which is also known as the grip of a lion's paw. That works and resurrects him. When Hiram Abiff's body is buried, it is concealed with something called a sprig of acacia. That is a flower sacred to the sun god Apollo. The resurrection of Hiram Abiff by the strong grip of the lion's paw is a reference to the sign of Leo, which is the soul house of the sun. The concept of the dying and resurrected sun god is replete in mythology, comparative religion, and of course, you know, we get into controversial subject matter about this. I don't really mind talking about it, but it's one of the sub, and I'll certainly talk about it with you, but it's one of the subject matters that gets me into trouble over on Facebook, and it's one of the subject matters that I've received what you would want to call some of the more mean-spirited emails about, where you get into Christianity, you know, the concept of the dying and resurrected sun god, which is, you know, Jesus. It's, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Being dead for 3 days and coming out of the tomb, you know, at the vernal equinox. you know, the crucifixion, which is a solar, you know, astrological allegory. We just talked about, you know, the 12 fellow craft looking for the lost sun god. This is parodied, or not parodied, this is, you know, comparatively brought to light with the 12 apostles who assist Christ the Son on his annual journey. This is in Judaism with the 12 tribes of Israel who, you know, are the 12 houses of the zodiac. This is allegory. And this is, you know, reflected in this third degree ritual and carried forward in this royal arch ritual, this concept of the resurrected sun, the sun bringing light to the world, the sun penetrating this lost vault, bringing forth the tetragrammaton, which allows the restoration of the somewhat forbidden yet lost legitimate knowledge.
Well, we'll certainly get back to what the more orthodox minds are saying about Freemasonry. But in the Royal Arch of Enoch, you suggest we might be entering a new solar age. What is a solar age, and what is the relevance of it?
This is, again, somewhat reflective of Freemasonry, because, again, you know, when you're getting into this third degree with the 12 houses, what we're really talking about here is, again, this concept of the sun god. And when I say the sun god, that's with a U, not an O. And what we're dealing with when we talk about solar ages, we're dealing with what's called the Platonic year. This is an astronomical event called the precession of the equinoxes. It's a little hard, if someone is coming to this material for the first time, it's a little hard to understand, but I'm going to do my best to try to explain it. Basically, the way it works is the sun, our sun, is in one house of the zodiac for approximately 2,000 years. For the last 2,000 years, the sun has been in the house of Pisces, what's called the Piscean Age. 2,000 years before that, we were in the house of Aries the Ram, and 2,000 years before that, we were in the house of Taurus the Bull. We are now 2,000 years into Pisces, and we are currently leaving it, heading into the next house, which is Aquarius. The reason we know that the sun remains in this one house for 2,000 years is because on the vernal equinox, which is around approximately March 21st of every year, the sun rises behind this particular sign. And with the precessional cycle, the sun moves backwards each degree, moves backwards through these houses of the zodiac one degree every 72 years. So it takes about 2,000 years for the sun to recycle itself in one particular house and go into another house. This is a phenomenon caused by a gravitational pull on our sun, most likely by a planet or one of the stars in the Pleiades. Some suggest by the star Spica in the constellation Virgo, that this is debatable. But what the Royal Arch delves into is that the solar symbology, the sort of adoration of the sun these 2,000 years, reflects a new religious tradition that emerges. For example, let's go back 4,000 years. We're in the age of Taurus the Bull. What do you have? You have bull worship. You have the Apis bull worship in Egypt. You have myths about minotaurs and mazes. The maze is a solar emblem. The minotaur has the bull head. This is, you know, the adoration of the sun in the house of Taurus. Then we go into the house of Aries. You know, Aries is a fire sign. You know, we keep a concept of Abraham with the ram in the thorn bush. You know, there are numerous fire elements contained within the Hebrew religion. Mithraism has fire adoration. Zoroastrianism.
Mithras kills the bull.
Mithras lays the bull heading into the new age of Aries. That's absolutely right. Then we get into 2,000 years ago. Well, now we're exiting the fire sign of Aries and entering Pisces. Well, what do we have? We've got the Piscean fisherman Jesus, the son of God, who walks on water. Well, Pisces is a water sign, who washes people's feet. Well, Pisces, you know, is the ruler of the feet. Jesus was born of the Virgin. That's the opposite house of Pisces. You know, we've got, you know, is the fisher of men, who feeds his followers with two fishes. This is all the, you know, emblems of the Piscean sun or adoration. Now, 2,000 years later, here it is 2012, or 2013, leaving 2012, and now the sun is exiting Pisces. It has been for some time. The sun just doesn't jump around from one house to the other, but slowly and slowly we're exiting Pisces and we're entering into Aquarius, the next house up. What does that mean? the deacons of Aquarius are equality, freedom, brotherhood. It's basically the doctrines of Freemasonry, the concepts of universal brotherhood. That's the symbolism that's so important to me and which I talk about in the Royal Arch book.
Tell us about Thomas Campanella and the City of the Sun.
What you have happening syncretically with the House of Aquarius becoming exalted and exiting the House of Pisces, we, of course, have the birth of the United States, which is what I suggest in my book is why, well, I don't suggest that, I state it, which is a Masonic Republic. And, of course, if you're going to have a Masonic Republic, you're going to have a capital city that is replete with solar iconography. And again, remember, let's just go back to the basics. I mean, let's just step back for a minute. You go into Blue Lodge Freemasonry. The worshipful master sits in the east representing the sun. This is what brings life to the world. The life and light in the world is the sun, who sheds wisdom upon his knowledge, or enlightenment. So what you have in this country is you have the federal district, which is, of course, our capital, Washington, D.C., and you have numerous solar iconography in that city. I say in the book that probably the most utopian reference for the federal district is a novella. It's a utopian novella written by a Dominican friar known. It's called The City of the Sun. The guy who wrote it is named Tommaso Campanella. And the full title of this work is The City of the Sun, a conversation between a Genoese seamaster or sea captain and then master of the Knights Hospitallier. It's published around 1613, 1614, and in it, it describes that this captain has come back from the New World. What's that? And, when he's there, he's seen this capital city, this new City of the Sun. And the Grand Master said to him, talk to me about it. What did you see? And one of the first things he says out of his mouth is, he says, well, the capital city has a giant building that sits on a hill with a dome on it. And again, this is reflective of our capital. People like Latrobe and Mills and L'Enfant, people who, helped plan this federal district would have clearly, and Daniel Carroll as well, would have clearly have been aware of this utopian work. And the symbolism of the dome on a building, and again, I'm excluding commercial buildings or a shopping center or something like that, that comes out of the works of a Roman architect named Vitruvius, who lived around the turn of the last, age over. He was there in the early 100s, common era, basically. And he's a city planner, he's an architect, and Vitruvius writes a book, I believe it's called 10 Books of Architecture, maybe 4 books. But anyway, his work is reinterpreted by these two Renaissance masters, the main one being Andre Palladio, and they say that basically if you're going to put a dome on a building, it's basically turning it into a chamber of the sun god Apollo. And you'll see this, it has three really symbolic importances. Number one is if you're going to put it on a government building like our U.S. Capitol, what it's designating it as basically a chamber of the sun meaning like New Age democracy or New Age enlightenment. If you put it on a library like you have in the Bodleian, it's basically a chamber of light meaning enlightenment. And if you want to put it on an actual religious structure like in the Vatican, St. Peter's Basilica, or the Baltimore Basilica here in downtown where I'm at right now, you're actually doing legitimately of a chamber of sun worship where basically the sun god Apollo or Mithras, or Horus is being adored under the name of Jesus, basically. And that's the symbology of the dome on a building, as it were. The Masons who are planning the federal district, you have the Capitol building. I say in the book that it's probably the most salient utopic reference for the federal district. There are other solar icons in the federal district, the most notably, with the exception of the United States Capitol building, would be the Washington Monument, which is, of course, an obelisk. Then we're dealing with symbolism relating to the sun god of Egypt, Amun-Re, or Horus, or even Osiris. And then you get into sort of these concepts of the federal triangle. This is becoming more and more out in the open now, where you have this federal district within a federal district almost. You have the White House to the Washington Monument, then up back to the Capitol building, with the hypotenuse being Pennsylvania Avenue, forming this Pythagorean triangle. Well, if you know anything about mysticism or even Rosicrucianism, you'll know that the Pythagorean triangle is representative of the sun god Osiris, his virgin wife Isis, and the hypotenuse is their perfected child Horus. Interestingly, in the Federal District, and my book is one of the few, if not the only one, that talks about this, the hypotenuse that connects the two branches of our elective government, the United States Capitol Building, which seats the Senate and the House, and the White House, which is, of course, the executive, is called Pennsylvania Avenue. Pennsylvania is the keystone state, and this ties into royal arch symbology, because without a keystone, a royal arch cannot stand. You can't have an archway without a keystone. And I get into the symbology of a keystone, which is a long story, but it's another solar emblem. And if you know, when you get into the Federal District of Washington, D.C., and, you know, its astrological alignments, you know, you will see that this is, you know, basically the New World's city of the sun.
And, Robert, one of the main influences or legacies of Freemasonry, and this may surprise a lot of people, but you do go in depth in your book, is the building of the Erie Canal. Tell us about that.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, if you look at the birth of our young nation back in the day, you know, I guess you had, you know, if you were going to rate things as important, number one would be the creation of your federal district. Number two would probably be the Baltimore Basilica. And then number three would be the Erie Canal. The Erie Canal was built under the aegis of a royal arch mason named DeWitt Clinton. And DeWitt Clinton is penultimately important because he basically becomes the grand master of royal arch Freemasonry in 1797 when the Royal Arch Grand Chapter is formed in Boston. And the Erie Canal is really, if you know what a canal system is, it's rising and it's rising and sinking waters. And what the Erie Canal does was it connected New York basically to the Great Lakes, to the Mississippi, and ultimately down to the Mississippi Delta. The Erie Canal is rising waters is actually a symbol of the flooding of the Nile. And this is actually referenced, the flooding of the Nile is actually referenced in James Anderson's Constitutions of Freemasonry. And what Anderson says is, and we're dealing with the, you know, 1720s. This was right after 1717, the forming of the Grand Lodge in London. Anderson is a Presbyterian minister, and in his legendary Constitutions, he says, well, Freemasonry became improved, that's the exact word he uses, or bettered through the measurement of the flooding of the Nile. And what you have with the Erie Canal is the flooding, you know, the symbolic rising and sinking of the waters to get boats out west. What it is emblematic of is the Nile. And if you actually look, I mean, this is where it really gets interesting, and it's in my book. If you actually look at when they opened the Erie Canal in 1824, if you actually look at the ball ticket for the Erie Canal ball, it actually features the caduceus of Hermes on it. And, of course, Hermes is penultimately important to the Royal Arch, you know, legend and history, if you will, as Hermes is the guy who ultimately penetrates the vault, pronounces the Tetragrammaton correctly, and restores the seven liberal arts and sciences. The concept of westward movement, of Freemasonry and Royal Arch degree Freemasonry, which involves, you know, which we talked about earlier, the recovery of this lost name of God, this is talked about by a Freemason named Salem Town. That's not a place I'm talking about. That's an actual name, Salem Town. And Town writes a treatise called A System of Speculative Freemasonry. I want to say off the top of my head, it's published around 1817, 1819. I can't remember the exact date. But what Town basically is talking about is the symbolic westward expansion of Royal Arch Freemasonry, and Freemasonry in general is basically expansion of this lost name, logos, if you will, into the Western territories, basically proclaiming the United States as this grand Masonic Royal Arch Republic, if you will.
And Robert, going back to what you were talking about, the emails and the Facebook posts and so forth, what are some of the polemics from the more orthodox-minded that make your eyes roll on a good day and bang your head on a bad day?
Well, I've gotten, I mean, you know, when It's, for starters, let me just say it's few and far between, and as of late, it's really dying down. I think that of late, more people are becoming more and more aware of this knowledge. I know for a fact that 20 years ago, this knowledge would have kind of not been laughed at, but kind of would have been not taken as legitimately it is now. I think people are more thirsting for this knowledge than they were. But when I get on Facebook, you know, it's one out of every 100 people. I mean, I've gotten the comments of, you know, Freemasonry is devil worship. You're going to burn in hell. You know, yeah. I mean, you know, recant right now, or, you know, you're doomed forever. My experience with this is I just delete the comment. I never ever get into some sort of online debate with these people. That to me is just a big no-no. I mean, that's what they're looking for, you know, is to tie up your time with them. And I, you know, when it comes along, and of late I haven't had anything, but you know, when I do get it occasionally, I just delete it. I mean, I just delete it and ignore it. You talk about eye rolling. I'll tell you a story. It really wasn't with Facebook. This happened a couple years ago, but it's interesting. And you know, we talk about the, you know, it ties into your question about like the reception of this knowledge and banging your head and rolling your eyes. I was down in downtown Baltimore. I was at one of my local watering holes, sitting on a bar stool with a buddy of mine, and we just started talking about Freemasonry, and I got into the conversation of, you know, the Illuminati with him. You know, and this was the historical Illuminati of 1776 of Adam Weishaupt. You know, and it's nothing, you know, scandalous or anything. But as I was talking to him, we were just having a friendly conversation. I could see this one guy sitting about five stools away from me, and he started rolling his eyes and shaking his head. And, you know, I mean, I could just see the skepticism. Well, after about 15 minutes, my friend had to get up and use the men's room, and the guy, interjected and said, listen, he said, this isn't my business. He said, but why are you filling your buddy with all this nonsense about the Illuminati and the, you should know better than this? I said, well, wait a minute. What do you mean? And this was his answer. He said, well, everybody knows that the Illuminati is an invention of Dan Brown. I mean, and I just like my, you know, it's like, you know, my jaw, let me pick my jaw up off the floor. And I said to him, I said, sir, I said, you know, you believe whatever you want to believe. I said, but let me just say this to you. I said, when you leave here tonight and you go home or wherever it is you're going, I said, if you don't want to do it tonight, do it tomorrow. I said, when you get a minute, I said, go on to either Wikipedia or Google. I said, I want you to Google this name. I want you to Google the name of Adam Weishaupt. I said, just take a look at that and tell me what you see. You know, if I ever see you again, whatever, I don't know you from Adam, but, you know, just do yourself a favor and take a look at that. It was about a month later, I was back in there, and the guy came in, and he actually apologized to me. He said, you know, you were right. He said, I did what you said. He said, and, you know, I had no clue about any of this information. You know, so, I mean, it was one of those things where, you know, it was like redeemed at last, basically.
And it's interesting that even the most orthodox-minded will look at the Bible and say, well, this has different levels. There's allegory, literalism, whatever. But when it comes to Freemason symbolism or stuff, they won't accept the fact that it has many levels as anything in the esoterica.
Well, when you get into the Bible, the whole thing, I mean, my take on it is, and I say this in the Royal Arch, I think the whole thing is all a metaphor. I think, you know, I mean, even in the Old Testament, you know, you got Joseph with the 12 brothers, Jesus with the 12 apostles. I mean, at Revelation 22:16, Jesus says, I am the morning star. I mean, the morning star is the sun. Okay. I mean, this is in the Bible. I mean,
right.
You know, this isn't me talking or just making stuff up. I mean, Jesus, you know, says, I am the morning star. Well, the morning star is the sun, not to be confused with the sun of the morning star or Venus. I've maintained in the book the whole thing is just one giant astrological metaphor. Loads of Christian writers. I mean, and these are the guys you're never going to hear about. You know, forget Thomas Aquinas. I mean, I'm talking about the second century guys. You know, guys like Origen, Tertullian, Martyr, or Justin Martyr. I mean, Origen says in his writings, he says, you know, when it comes to Christianity, there are two doctrines, the esoteric and the exoteric. You know, one is not written down and is for the initiate, and the other is for the, you know, basically, you know, the profane masses who are meant to believe this is real history relating to real people. You know, and within Masonry, you know, as a candidate, you'll just go through and, you know, you'll see the ritual and you'll go through and you won't think anything of it, not knowing that, you know, you're going through this sort of, you know, symbolic solar allegory, you know, which won't be given to you. I mean, unless you sit down, which few Freemasons do, and start reading Albert Pike, Albert Mackey, you know, the Manly Palmer Halls of the world. And, you know, yes, I agree with you. There are multiple levels to this.
And Robert, in keeping in theme with the show, what are some of the Gnostic influences on Freemasonry? You already discussed Hermes Trismegistos. Are there any others? I find it interesting, like Albert Pike talks about a Johannine influence, a Knights Templar. Do you give credence to these, or what are some of the other ones?
Yes. Well, when we're talking about what you're talking about is absolutely true. What we're talking about is the fourth gospel of St. John. This ties in with what is ultimately a heresy called Doceticism, where it's basically Jesus wasn't a real person, he was a spirit. What Pike is talking about is, and this opens up the Gospel of St. John, that says, you know, Jesus is the Word. Well, what's the Word? What's the name of God? It's this tetragrammaton, and it's logos, and it's symbolic. And the Gnostics, I believe, you know, and again, we're going way back. I mean, we're talking pre, you know, Council of Nicaea here in whatever was 325. You know, I think they understood that, you know, this story, this Jesus was this New Age Piscean sun god. I think that's what they were ultimately into. Ultimately, this gets corrupted or changed around where, you know, with the council, this is meant to be now legitimate history or real history, if you were. The Gnostic, you know, influence, you know, with regard to Freemasonry, what it is to me and what I say in the Royal Arch, and I think what it was to Pike, is it's that this secret that these characters in the Bible, what, you know, the Latin would be, you know, your dramatis personae, if you will, is really just an allegory. And you see the Gnostic teachings reflect this, you know, that Jesus is this, you know, mystical, you know, creature, if you will, preaching this, you know, New Age spirituality, if you will. And what I suggest in, you know, it's this sort of, you know, what you want to call underground, you know, philosophy, if you will, that and Pike mentions it also, that is basically being transferred down through this New Age, through these groups like the Cathars, the Templars, ultimately the Rosicrucians, even the Jesuits talk about this, the Illuminati, which ultimately turns into what you would call modern day Freemasonry, where the rituals are trying to reflect the story, you know, of the dying yet resurrected sun god.
Robert, the topic of the Illuminati is still very popular from both within secret societies and definitely outside of secret societies, especially people trying to sensationalize the Illuminati. Where do you stand with it, and can you tell us your views on it?
Sure. The Illuminati is an interesting phenomenon. People know the Illuminati. What is, you know, penultimately important with them is really their political methodology, which is what you would call Illuminism, which is sort of the transformation of the world into this perfected quasi-Masonic temple, if you will. My take on the Illuminati is a little different than other people's. We know that the founder of the Illuminati was a guy named Adam Weishaupt. He founded it on May the 1st, 1776 in Bavaria. Anyone who knows anything about the pagan mysteries, as it were, will know the importance of that date, May the 1st. That's, of course, Beltane. That's basically the spring equivalent of Halloween. At any rate, Weishaupt founds it as sort of this new, brand new sort of militant-styled Freemasonry that's going to be this social equality, bring about social equality. It's sort of anti-monarchy, anti-Vatican, anti-religion. It grows and becomes very popular, and part of its popularity stems from a guy joining it named Adolf Knigge, or Adolf Knig. He's a German aristocrat. Knigge's a Freemason. He gets Knigge to join the Illuminati, and when Knigge joins, he brings a whole host of German Freemasons with him into the Illuminati. That's when their ranks really swell. This is where things really get a little dicey, is because Knigge, after joining it, shortly thereafter leaves the order, and he writes a treatise about why he left. And he says to the effect of, I'm a Freemason, and I joined this group because I believed, you know, in Weishaupt. I believed in this sort of, you know, democratic, you know, Pythagorean, you know, fire that he was expounding of equality, you know, of leveling the playing field, you know, sort of anti-monarchy, anti-Vatican, anti-religion. He said, I bought into that. He said, I'm leaving it because after being a part of it, I can tell you right now, this is Carnegie speaking. He said, I can tell you emphatically that the Illuminati order, this is the Illuminati of Weishaupt, was nothing more than the Jesuits under another name. What's really interesting about this, and when people hear this for the first time, you know, you can almost see their eyes rolling or shrugging their shoulders. You have to remember something. The Illuminati of Weishaupt of Bavaria of 1776 comes onto the scene shortly thereafter when the Jesuits or the Society of Jesus was suppressed by Pope Clement XIV. In 1773, Pope Clement suppresses the Society of Jesus because of their political intrigues, of their, you know, conspiring against European leaders. You have numerous leaders of the Jesuits fascinated by Egyptian mysticism, Egyptian symbology. The Jesuit priest Athanasius Kircher wrote on this extensively, saying that he believed, you know, that there were elements of Christianity that were incorporating the elements of the Egyptian mysteries, you know, of Osiris, Isis, Horus, concepts related to the Holy Trinity, which he believed was a solar icon coming out of Egypt. Pope Clement has had enough by 1773, and he puts the Jesuits all but out of existence. And it's shortly thereafter that you have the Illuminati come on the scene. And it's almost as if the Jesuits have just gone underground and are just using the Illuminati, or at least that title, as a front or cover. Because if you actually look at your history, I mean, the amazing thing is when the Jesuits go out of business in 1773, then boom, a couple years later, you got the Illuminati. Well, the Illuminati sort of disappears around the early, you know, 1800s, 1805, 1810, during the Napoleonic Wars. The Illuminati sort of kind of fades into the background, and then you have the conclusion of the, you know, the Wars of Napoleon. And then what happens? Well, the Jesuits are restored and the restoration of the Papal States. So, I mean, it was almost like the Jesuits were just going underground for this sort of 10, 15-year period and then just reemerge again as the Jesuits. Where I believe the Illuminati is very important is you will clearly see their influence, at least politically, on the development of both the United States of America, the sort of, you know, revolutionary zeal which you see coming out of Philadelphia in 1776, of course, the American Revolution, the rebellion against Great Britain. Obviously, you'll see it in the French Revolution, probably a little more explicitly. Weishaupt had written a treaty, I can't remember what it's called, but it was basically about Pythagoras and how, you know, the Pythagorean teachings, you know, represented this perfected society. You look at the French Revolution, you know, I mean, what's the penultimate symbol of the French Revolution? I mean, it's the guillotine. You know, well, what's the guillotine? Well, it's a Pythagorean right triangle, you know, which was used to basically get rid of the so-called, you know, quote-unquote enemies of the state. The Illuminati definitely sort of disappears off the history books in the 1800s, in the early 1800s. But what is important is their sort of political fire, the revolutionary zeal, if you will, it's definitely carried on in other societies. Namely, and this was George Washington talked about this a little bit, he thought it had come into America through the Jacobite societies, the Democratic clubs. You know, and the Jacobites, of course, were the real fiery leaders of the French Revolution. The main group that Illuminism goes into during the 19th century in Europe is a group called the Carbonari, or the charcoal burners. That's what that means. They are basically sort of this revolutionary brotherhood that are basically behind the revolutions of 1832 and 1848, and you can attribute that to the influence of the Illuminati.
And Robert, wasn't Weishaupt himself tied with the Jesuits? He was a professor or a teacher?
Yes, absolutely. Carnegie says this in his works. Weishaupt was trained by the Jesuits. Numerous leaders of the Illuminati were trained by the Jesuits. One of the main ones, Weishaupt aside, was a guy named Ignaz von Born. And von Born is the head of the Illuminati temple in Vienna, Austria. He's important because he's left out of the movie, but von Born is the Illuminati Freemasonic influence on Mozart. And von Born basically inspires Mozart to compose his Masonic Illuminati opera called The Magic Flute. And Ignaz von Born actually serves as the inspiration of the character of Zarathustra in The Magic Flute.
And there are people who say that the Illuminati were basically atheists. Do you see them as atheists or simply just very rabidly anti-religion?
I wouldn't say they were atheists at all. They were basically what you would call militant deists. I definitely think they were hinged towards the side of being anti-Rome. But my research has led me to believe they were not atheists at all. They were basically what you would call extreme or militant deists, and they just believed in sort of, you know, a supreme being type of character. This carries again into the French Revolution, where you'll see guys like Robespierre putting on, you know, the cult of the supreme being, or, you know, the worship of reason. It was God, was reason and knowledge, not some sort of mythical, you know, fantastical creature. God was light, reason, the supreme being. That was my take on them.
And ultimately, Robert, what do you see as the impact of Freemasonry on our modern culture?
Well, I think that, you know, when you look at the United States today, I mean, and I think I do very well document this in my book, is, I mean, clearly, you know, we have a lot of the founding, I mean, this has been talked about before, you have a lot of the founding fathers were Freemasons, you know, the development of this country, you know, Washington, our first president, was a Mason. Numerous of his generals in his corps during the Revolution were Masons. You got Henry Knox, who was a Mason. He becomes the first Secretary of War. He founds another secret society called the Order of Cincinnati, which is, for lack of a better word, his attempt to form an American aristocracy. Hamilton was involved with this. And when you look at when they're really after the Revolution, this sort of is in the time frame of after, you know, 1781 to, let's say, around 1800. You know, I mean, these guys are meeting in Philadelphia to create the government. You know, I mean, well, where do you see Freemasonry in all this? Well, I'm going to tell you. You have the triple division of government, you know, between an executive, judicial, and a legislative branch. This comes straight out of Masonic Lodge, where you have the triple division of government within a Blue Lodge between the worshipful master and the junior and senior wardens. This is, again, another solar icon of the rising sun, the sun at noon, and the setting sun. You know, you have our federal district, which is basically, you know, which we talked about earlier, being this city representing the sun or solar iconography. Even in the early days of the Republic, you know, you see things like when Adams is president. This is after Washington serves his two terms and Adams comes in. You have the adoption of the Jay Treaty, where basically the United States throws our French allies under the bus and takes the side of the British. And this was, again, when the French Revolution was in its fever, as it were. You can definitely successfully argue that the adoption of the Jay Treaty was based on, you know, Freemasonry and the fear of the Illuminati. Adams was very skeptical of the French and the French Revolution. Many people had written, and the main guy is a guy named Jebediah Morse, who basically wrote a treatise in America saying the French Revolution was a bloodbath orchestrated by the Illuminati. You know, Jefferson is sort of pegged in this corner with this group because of his ambassadorship to the French Republic. And in a nutshell, the election of 1800 is decided over this fear of the Illuminati, where Adams is thrown out. Eventually, the Federalists are defeated. Jefferson is elected president. Notwithstanding, the Jay Treaty was still adopted, but Jefferson comes in and takes this very pro-French stance. Of course, this leads to the Louisiana Purchase, and ultimately, you have Jefferson and Jeffersonian politics dominating the next 10 years. And then, of course, you know, by that time, England has had enough of this, says, where's our Jay Treaty? And you got Jefferson's disciples like Monroe and Madison, who basically say, well, we're not going along. And that, of course, leads to the War of 1812. you know, I mean, there is clear influence with, you know, the influence of Masonry on that time frame in history.
And in your book, you offer a very compelling chapter on Masonic symbols in modern cinema. Could you tell us about it, since film tends to be a powerful conduit or reference and perspective in our modern culture?
Yeah, sure. It's good that we talk about this, because it's the final chapter of my book, and I'm real glad you asked me about this, because it actually leads me into my second book, which I'm currently writing. The final chapter deals with Masonic influence and Enochian influence in some movies. And when I was writing that chapter, I had in the back of my head some more, you know, esoteric, you know, dualistic, you know, ideas, you know, or not ideas, you know, topics I wanted to talk about other movies, but I didn't really feel like it fit into the book, into the Royal Arch book. So my second book that I'm writing right now deals with more Masonic, esoteric, you know, concepts relating to dualism, alchemy, mysticism, the occult, into modern movies. But in the Royal Arch, the final chapter deals with movies such as, like, for example, the first National Treasure movie. Well, the first National Treasure movie with Nicolas Cage is literally a replication of the Royal Arch degree. It's the recovery of Freemasonry, of the Templars underneath the Holy Ground, you know, which in the movie was Trinity Church in New York. In the ritual, it's the Temple Mount where Solomon's Temple once sat, and they're building the second temple of Zerubbabel. You got the concepts of, you know, decoding the clues to locate, you know, this treasure vault, you know, and it's the same thing in the Masonic ritual. It's the treasure vault of Freemasonry, you know, where this esoteric wisdom is kept, you know, under the holy ground. I get into, you know, concepts related to the movie Being There. This was a movie that came out, I want to say, in 78, 79. You know, you've got the guy Rand who you know, is part of this sort of secret cabal at the end being put into the Masonic slash, you know, esoteric crypt, which is the back of the $1, which is the, you know, the truncated pyramid with the eye on top of it, you know, and as he's being placed in the crypt, you know, they're talking about, well, who are we going to select for the next, you know, United States president, you know, and you've got the character, the Peter Sellers character of Chauncey Gardner, you know, who is trying to say Chauncey the Gardner, but everyone misinterprets it as Chauncey Gardner. I mean, if you listen to what he says in the book, he's just another one of these solar heroes. I mean, all he does is drone on and on about the, you know, solstices and equinoxes, you know, about, you know, the sun comes out in, you know, spring and we replant, and then the trees and life die, and we have the vault of winter, and then the sun is born again. You know, it's just another solar hero. I tie this into the movie and generally the Arthurian legend. You know, and it's again, you know, King Arthur is the sun, you know, Excalibur is, you know, the sun ray, which he pulls from the stone, you know, Christ emerges from the, you know, the stone when it's rolled away, you know, Arthur has the 12 knights, you know, the 12 houses of the zodiac. I mean, it's the same, you know, replication, you know, you've got the character of Merlin in the Arthurian legend, the guy who keeps the wisdom, you know, this is the Hermes character, you know, this character is all over the place in modern cinema, you know, sort of the old hermit with the gray beard who, you know, the hero meets, and this is the character who has all the answers, but is somewhat, you know, reluctant to give them away. You know, it's Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars, Yoda in Empire, Albus Dumbledore in the Harry Potter films, it's Merlin in the Arthurian legend. You know, I tie all that in together. And, you know, what's one of the other movies
Ninth Gate.
Oh, The Ninth Gate. Oh, my God. That thing is replete with Kabbalistic symbolism. That's one of my all-time favorites. You know, you've got the character of Balkan, you know, the book collector who is trying to unlock these nine gates. The nine gates are really, you know, the movie ties it in with devil worship, which is basically done for, you know, a lurid, you know, appeal. You know, devil worship sounds a whole lot more appealing than Hebrew Kabbalah. But it's basically the nine gates of the nine, you know, Sephirot, you know, which once unlocked lead to this tenth gate, which you get this divine wisdom. But the Balkan character is, you know, which I say in my book is reflective of this, you know, English mystic named Aleister Crowley. You've got the book the guy who has the book back in the day, who's burnt alive, the Torquay, I think his name was. This is reflective of a Dominican friar named Giordano Bruno, who dabbled in this material and was ultimately burned at the stake. You know, you've got the Dali Melanicum. This is reflective of, you know, the satanic grimoire originally, you know, written by, you know, the devil. This reflects the H.P. Lovecraft Necronomicon. And, you know, you've got the plates in the book, which are, you know, very heavy overload with tarot card symbolism. And, you know, a lot of the images in the book from the movie really look similar to the engravings in the Lutheran Bible. Just a lot going on in that movie. It's the final part of the book. And, you know, right now I'm currently working on my second book. It's actually titled Cinema Symbolism. And I tie in Kabbalah, tarot cards, you know, mysticism, the occult, Freemasonry, both High and Blue Lodge, to movies like Star Wars, and I'm talking all six of them, the Back to the Future movies, the Omen trilogy, The Exorcist, films like Black Swan, which came out a couple years ago. That movie has tons to do with dualism. Same with the James Bond films. And, you know, that book I should have done at the end of the summer, early fall of this year. And I'm looking for probably an early 2014 release date.
Well, we certainly look forward to that book. But I think that's all the time we have today, Robert. I'd like to thank you very much for coming.
Hello and welcome to the Gnostic Warrior radio show and podcast, broadcasting from GnosticWarrior.com in San Diego, California, to around the world. I'm your host, Mo, and today on the show we have author and 32nd degree Freemason, Robert W. Sullivan IV. Robert is a philosopher, historian, jurist, theologian, writer, and lawyer who will discuss the esoteric doctrines contained in his new book, The Royal Arch of Enoch, The Impact of Masonic Ritual, Philosophy, and Symbolism. This work is over 20 years of research that is a true life, Da Vinci Code, and national treasure. So how you doing today, Robert? How's the weather there? And you're in Baltimore, Maryland, correct?
Yes, Mo. Hello. How are you? It's great to be here today on Gnostic Warrior. Right now, it's a little windy, a little rainy out. The major storm that was coming through basically missed us. We got some wind. It's been a little cool, around 41 degrees. Nothing too bad. Windy and a little cold, you know, overcast, but typical November weather here in Maryland.
Yeah, I know you guys have some storms coming your way, but again, that's kind of typical for this time of year, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The last couple winters here have been mild, to say the least. But, you know, typical, like 41 degrees, I want to say it is right now outside, which is your typical mid-November weather here in Maryland.
Okay, cool. And what I'd like to get into before we get into your book, The Royal Arch of Enoch, tell us a little bit about your background before, you know, you got into your research now up until that and the authoring of your book.
Sure. My name is Robert W. Sullivan IV. I was born here in Baltimore, Maryland. This is where I reside. I went to high school here. I graduated high school in 1990. High school I went to was called Friends School of Baltimore. It's a very old private school. I went to, my alma mater is Gettysburg College in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. I graduated there with a history degree in 1995. I technically should have been in the class of 1994. But I took a year off. I spent my junior year abroad at Oxford University. This would have been in 1990. This would have been the autumn of 1992 through the summer of 1993. I spent that at Oxford University at St. Catherine's College studying European history and philosophy. When I came back to the States, I did not return to Gettysburg. I took a year off. So let's see, this would have been around July of 1993 to around July of 1994. I worked at a program located on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. called the Washington International Studies Council. I was office director there for a year. When that ended, I went back to Gettysburg, and I finished my senior year at Gettysburg, 1994, 1995. Like I said, I graduated there with a BA in history. It was a couple years later, 1997, that I went to law school. I went to Widener University in Delaware. There's two Widener universities. There's one in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and there's one in Wilmington, Delaware. I went to the Wilmington, Delaware campus, and I earned my JD. That was awarded in 2000. From approximately 2001 to 2008, I worked at various law firms in the Baltimore metropolitan area, focusing primarily in the areas of insurance defense work, product liability, things like that. I became a Freemason in 1997. I applied for membership in the Lodge in 1996. This would have been in the summer of 1996. The Lodge I'm a member of is called Amicable St. John's Lodge No. 25. That's here in Baltimore, Maryland as well. When I applied, it was just known as Amicable Lodge No. 25. It's since merged with another lodge, and now it's Amicable St. John's Lodge No. 25. That's here in Baltimore. I applied for that, for the membership in that in the summer of 1996, and finally was raised to the degree of Master Mason in the fall of 1997. If the listeners aren't aware, during the summer months, and this is universal, Freemasonry goes dark. There's no lodge meetings in July and August. That dates back to the foundation of Freemasonry, where during the summer months it was too hot to meet, and the lodges obviously weren't air-conditioned back in the day. And as a tradition that goes on to this day, during the summer months, there's no Masonic Lodge meetings. So I became a Blue Lodge Mason, a Master Mason, in the fall of 1997, and I became a 32nd degree of the Scottish Rite in 1999. That would be the Valley of Baltimore, Orient of Maryland.
Good. That's what I was going to ask you. I'm glad you answered that question. It's interesting that your history, as far as where you grew up, is all in these locations that have a lot of Freemasonic history and also the foundations of our country. Did you feel that growing up in these areas and going to school before you became a Freemason? Did you know about that at all?
Well, I had always been interested from a very early age in things like mysticism, the esoteric, things like that. I should point out that in my family, lots of my great-grandfathers, my grandfathers, have all been Masons, so I come from a long line of Maryland Masons. It's something I always wanted to do, and of course, you know, when you're in college and things like that, it's sort of an afterthought. It really didn't take hold of me until after I got out of college, and the way I got in was, it was through my mother and father. It was, they're both antique dealers, and through a mutual friend of theirs who was in this lodge, I asked him if I could join, and he recommended me to the lodge. This would have been back in 1996, and this person's no longer alive, by the way. But growing up in this area, you know, especially when you get into, you know, the Baltimore-Washington area, yeah, I mean, you know, you will clearly see, you know, the Masonic influences upon these cities. At the time, even growing up, I kind of really wasn't cognizant of it. It really wasn't until after I became a Mason and you start learning about the Founding Fathers and their Masonic involvements, and then these Masonic architecture doing the designs of these, you know, cityscapes, that, you know, really becomes apparent. But in a nutshell, you know, during that time frame, I mean, I appreciated the history. Certainly the lodge, the Masonic lodge that I belong to, actually, the charter of the lodge actually predates the founding of Baltimore City. You're talking late 1700s, so it's one of the older lodges here in the state of Maryland. But growing up, I mean, I always appreciated the history. You know, we're here on the East Coast, so you definitely have, you know, ties to the Revolution, you know, with Baltimore, Philadelphia, Washington, that whole, you know, I-95 corridor. But growing up, you know, I always appreciated the history. I was a little really not cognizant of the Masonic history, per se. That really didn't take root until after I had joined the lodge. And really wasn't, you know, until the late 1990s, early 2000s, when you really start to read up about not only Washington and Franklin, but guys like L'Enfant, you know, Latrobe, Robert Mills, James Hoban, people like that.
Yeah, what's interesting to me is that I'm finding this out, even though you have a family with a strong Masonic history, it seems that they don't push that on the children. So say your father was a Mason and his grandfather, your grandfather, which was his father, was a Freemason. It seems like, you know, they didn't push that on you, and it was something that you had to come to at free will yourselves.
Yeah, I think you're right there, because if you take my father's side, on that line of the family, my grandfather, so my name is Robert W. Sullivan IV. This would be Robert W. Sullivan Jr. the second. He was a Mason. His father, Robert W. Sullivan Sr., was a Mason. He actually was a past master of a lodge. A past master is someone, is the title given to someone who has ruled the lodge for a year as what's called the worshipful master. After they step down, they're known as a past master. They were both active in masonry. Now, my father is not a Mason. It skipped over him.
Okay.
He had no interest in it whatsoever, and has no interest in it to this day. It's completely skipped over him and kind of went to me, and it was something I always was interested in. One of the things, I mentioned this on another show recently, to me, and it's inside and outside family relationships, I think for a Mason, one of the sort of worst things you can possibly try to do is try to cajole someone into joining a Masonic lodge who genuinely isn't interested. This usually results with disastrous consequences. I'm not disastrous, like life or death or anything, but usually what happens, I mean, I've seen this in my lodge where you have an older person who wants their grandson to join or a nephew or something like that, and the truth be told, the person has absolutely no interest in it, but is just doing it to appease, you know, the elder. They go through the ritual one time or the first degree ritual and you never see him again. And, you know, it's something that you should do unilaterally on your own. If you have to be talked into it, it's probably not for you. It's something within. For me, it was always something I wanted to do, so, you know, I was really anxious to join it. I know friends of mine who have no interest in it whatsoever. Alternatively, I have friends who have been very interested in it, who I've recommended to other lodges. This includes out-of-state lodges, lodges in Connecticut and New York, things like that. So it's really a personal decision, but, yeah, as a Mason, you know, if a person is genuinely not interested in it, probably better off just leaving them alone.
Yeah, I agree, definitely. What's interesting to me as well, it seems like there's two different classes of Freemasons that join the lodge. Of course, you would have classes yourself that seems like you're into, you know, the esoteric side of Freemasonry, as well as, I'm sure, the history and the different things that go along with it, with your book, The Royal Arch of Enoch. And then there's the other Freemasons that have no interest in the esoteric side of it and really don't have much knowledge in regards to the history of Freemasonry, and they're kind of just go through the motions, and it's more of kind of a club to them. Do you agree with that statement?
I would agree with it to an extent, and the extent would be this. I definitely think you have, you know, it seems to me, this is what I've observed, is it's you know, when you get into Freemasonry and you get into, I wouldn't necessarily say it's two classes, you definitely have Masons who are interested in the esoteric, you have Masons who are not interested in the esoteric. Certainly there's no wrong answer. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, you can't dictate a person what their interests are. I mean, for me, I like the esoteric side of it. Some Masons don't really, aren't that interested in it. What you really had was, at least, you know, this is what my research has led me to believe, and, you know, you can kind of see this throughout history, is with Masonry in this country, I'm just going to go through this as quick as I can.
Sure.
You know, you had this thing in the 1920s called the William Morgan Affair, which basically all but wiped out Masonry in this country. This guy, this, you know, newspaper editor, I believe he was, named William Morgan in New York, was threatening to reveal Masonic secrets. This didn't go over well. In a nutshell, he was taken over the Canadian line and disposed of, likely killed. We don't know to this day really what happened. But at any rate, the Masons who were put on trial, it was a kangaroo court. The judge was a Mason. The jury was a Mason. These guys were acquitted. There was this huge anti-Masonic backlash in the country. Masonry survived it, but one of the methods, one of the things it had to do in order to survive this attack was it had to distance itself from the esoteric and sort of the occult, mystical side of things. And Masonry reemerges as just a charitable, philanthropic organization. Now, don't get me wrong. I have nothing wrong with charity and philanthropic work, but it was really this philosophical doctrine that carried Masonry through the 19th century and pretty much through the 20th century. But now it seems that the pendulum is swinging back to more of the esoteric side. And what I credit this to is a couple things. One is the advent of the Internet in the late 1990s, 2000s, where you have this information much more accessible to people, and especially to younger people, where back in the day, you know, you never even heard of people. I mean, look, when I went through the ritual, you know, back in 1997, you know, I mean, I really wasn't an expert on Albert Pike or Manly Palmer Hall. You know, it wasn't until really afterwards that, you know, I really started understanding the, you know, the philosophical and symbolic importance of the rituals that I had just gone through. It was after the fact. But now you've got this younger generation, this internet generation, you know, who have grown up knowing nothing else, you know, and they can access the, you know, videos about Manly Palmer Hall or about esoteric masonry and Masonic symbolisms. Then you get, you know, the Dan Brown material and, of course, the National Treasure movies. This all, you know, has sort of revitalized masonry, but what it's done is it has definitely generated an interest in more of the esoteric side. I mentioned this on another show, and I'll mention it here. I want to say it was 2 or 3 years ago that Scottish Rite Southern Jurisdiction, that's the jurisdiction I'm in, did a poll of recent young men, and when I say young men, I think 35 and younger, who were joining the Masonic Lodge, and they asked them, what was your motivation in joining? Well, up until recently, up until this date, the answer given was the answer that I gave. It was either family connections, you know, family tradition, you know, or interest in helping the community, things like that. Well, in this poll that was given, it was something like, you know, 35%, 40% said they were, you know, joining Masonry due to the esoteric, you know, traditions of the fraternity, the occult mystical symbolisms. They were interested in this. So what you're beginning to see now is the pendulum swing back the other way, where, you know, Masonry is being revitalized and the esoteric, you know, mystical, numinous side of things is definitely taking hold once again.
It's interesting that we're seeing a lot of that here in the United States, and then you also hear, of course, there's the conspiracy, and I attribute that to people not understanding everything, and they misinterpret the Masonic symbols, the Masonic agenda, the different Masonic ties, and so forth. So that's why we have a big conspiracy on the internet that surrounds it. Do you believe that the Freemasons don't mind that this happens because it further conceals what they're doing and at the same time draws interest towards the craft?
Well, I think it is kind of a double-edged sword. I think it definitely draws interest. I mean, some of the stuff, I don't know if I would necessarily throw it into the conspiratorial world. I mean, you definitely have Masonic, you know, architecture around D.C., the templates of the cities. You know, this I document in the book. You know, of course, the founders of this country were Masons. You got the development of the United States Constitutions, which reflects the constitutions of Freemasonry. You've got a lot of the architects running around the country at the early stages at the birth of the country who are all Masons. You know, people like L'Enfant, Latrobe, Mills, Hoban, people like that. So, you know, Masonry definitely influenced, you know, the development of the country, and you'll see it in the architecture. Is it evidence of a vast conspiracy? No, not really. It's just they're using Masonry and its symbols and its related philosophies as nation-building devices is probably the best way I can describe it. Now, I will say in the earlier days of this country, you know, we're talking late 1700s, 1800s, early 1800s, you're definitely, you know, we'll see a Masonic influence, and you'll definitely see, you know, elements of Freemasonry working in secret, especially amongst some of the higher degrees, to influence policy, social development, economics over state lines. So you can definitely see a bit of a conspiratorial aspect to it. I don't think it was meant to be anything negative, but again, you know, this was part of the William Morgan backlash of the 1820s. This, you know, when this concept that Masons were working together over state lines to formulate policy didn't really go over too well. But then when you get into some of the stuff on the internet today, you know, I mean, some of it is just really, you know, out there. I mean, I try to stay away from the reptilian shapeshifters. some of that stuff. I think the craft definitely distanced itself from that. But for Masonry to be a fraternal organization that provides, you know, positive philosophical devices and nation building and things like that, I don't think it's really necessary too conspiratorial. I guess I can see where it's perceived that way, but I guess I see, you know, I see a positive influence where a lot of people may see a negative influence.
Yeah, no, I agree. If you really think about it, it's out there for everybody to see and to witness for themselves. You know, the United States of America, the first president was a Freemason, George Washington, and several presidents thereafter were as well. And it seems like it's more of a secret thing now. Who knows if it deals with the Morgan affairs or basically that we don't know who's a Freemason now. Well, as far as presidency. So would you say the United States was a Freemasonic built country? Because you were saying nation building? Okay.
Yes. Well, what I have, just real quick, because you threw something out. Yeah, when you get into like the presidents, a lot of this stuff is part of the public domain. Now, you know, there's no like database where you can go and look up to see who's a Freemason and who isn't. A lot of the more famous people is pretty commonly known, whether they're a Mason or not. You know, a lot of them wear rings like myself or a lapel pin, identifying themselves as a Mason. And you're correct, you know, Washington was a Mason. He's, of course, our first president. You have a lot of other Masons a lot of other presidents who have been Masons, people in Congress, the Senate, Supreme Court. I want to say the last president to be a Mason was Gerald R. Ford. He was really the last Masonic president that we've had. President Reagan was honorary, so I kind of really don't count him. And before Ford, you have to go back to Harry Truman and FDR. Those were the last three Masonic presidents. When you get into the concept of the United States, I have a chapter in the book called The United States of Freemasonry. And I present that the United States is what I describe as a Masonic republic. It's the world's first Masonic republic. You will see this, you will see evidence of this in the architecture of the federal city, Washington, D.C. You will see this paralleled in Baltimore, Maryland, which is right up the street from D.C. You will see this in the triple division of government in the country, where you have the government being divided threefold between an executive, a legislative body, and a judicial body. This comes out of Blue Lodge Freemasonry, where the governance of a lodge is triple divided between a worshipful master and the junior and senior wardens. This triple division is echoing the three phases of the sun, the rising sun, the sun at midday, and the setting sun. This is what a Masonic lodge is laid out upon, where you have the worshipful master sitting in the east representing the rising sun, and the two wardens, one sits in the south, one sits in the west, representing the sun at midday and the setting sun. So the triple division of government is a solar reference, but is coming out of Blue Lodge Freemasonry. And, of course, you will have things such as the separation of church and state. This is another Masonic doctrine. This comes out of the constitutions of Freemasonry. This is published in the early 1720s by a Presbyterian minister named James Anderson. This is shortly after the formation of the Grand Lodge in 1717 in England, where you have these legendary constitutions being drafted. And in these constitutions, Anderson basically removes a religious requirement to join Freemasonry. He makes it deistic, where you have to believe in a supreme being, a godlike creature or figure. It's known in Masonry as the Grand Architect of the Universe. But however that individual decides to get there is up to that individual Mason. Anderson does not put a Christian or Jewish or Muslim or Buddhist requirement on it. He says if you're any one of those three, or you're just a deist, you can join whatever your own religion is, or your path to God is your own. So the concept of separation, you know, from governance of religion is clearly, you know, embedded in Freemasonry prior to the United States Constitution. So, yeah, you will clearly see evidence of Freemasonry's fingerprints all over the founding of this country, in its governance, in its constitution, and even in its architecture.
What's the difference between the UK and America? Because my understanding, in the UK, you do not have to believe in a supreme deity.
In order to join a Blue Lodge, you are supposed to profess belief in a supreme being,
a god.
You have some philosophical differences going on between English Masonry, American Masonry, and what's called Continental Masonry, and I'll try to plow over this as quickly as I can because it's a long story. But what you have happening is, in England, you have the concept. There's a publication that comes in the 1700s by a man named William Preston, and it's called The Illustrations of Freemasonry. And in this, Preston outlines what it means to be an English Freemason. In a nutshell, he compares a Mason to the architect Vitruvius, and that he was a loyal subject of the Roman Emperor. What he's essentially saying is that to become an English Freemason, you are the most loyal subject of the monarch, of the English monarch. And this is a philosophy coming out of the works of an English lawyer named John Fortescue. Well, this philosophy carries on in the United States, of course, until the Revolution, where obviously, we distance ourselves from the English monarchy. We declare ourselves independent. We fight a revolution and win. So after the revolution, masonry is left beholding the question, well, if we're not loyal, if the Mason isn't loyal to the English subject anymore, what are we? And the question's answered twofold. It's answered by a man named Thomas Smith Webb, who also writes a treatise called The Illustrations of Freemasonry. Webb's monitor and Preston's monitor have the exact same name. They're both called The Illustrations of Freemasonry. The difference is that Webb's monitor ends with the Royal Arch Ceremonial, where Preston's ritual synthesis ends with the Masonic Master Mason degree, where the English candidate becomes a Master Mason, is the most loyal subject to the monarch. Webb alters this, where the ritual synthesis really ends with the Royal Arch Ceremonial, where the candidate beholds the Tetragrammaton, the name of God, the lost word of Hiram Abiff, the lost word of a Master Mason, and becomes a citizen, priest, king, monarch himself. And then the question is asked, well, if we're not, how do we remove the English monarch from our Masonic lodges? And the question answers itself. The English monarch is replaced with George Washington, who is basically the Masonic godfather of the country. So you will have this split between English Masonry and American Masonry. It's philosophical difference. Obviously we don't have a monarchy here. And also you will see in English Masonry a distance, it sort of distanced itself from what are called the higher degrees of Masonry, the Scottish Rite and York Rite. These are the two premier higher degree systems in this country. These are born both out of the same acorn. These are what comes out of what are called the 25 Rites of Perfection by a man named Henry Franken in Albany, New York. These degrees are ultimately developed in the mid-1700s in Paris, France, by the Society of Jesus as part of the Counter-Reformation. And, of course, if you know anything about England, the French are their arch enemies. They don't like the Society of Jesus. This is the group that tried to assassinate Queen Elizabeth. And, of course, Henry VIII, her father, of course, booted the Roman Catholic Church basically out of England, after the Henrican settlement where he gets rid of the Roman Catholic Church so he can divorce, the first queen. Her name's escaping me right now. And, of course, you have the creation of the Church of England, which is essentially the Roman Catholic Church, only it's Protestant, where the chief of the Church of England is the monarch, who is the de facto pope of the Church of England. So you will definitely see these philosophical splits between English Masonry, Continental Masonry, and American Freemasonry. And this is all fully outlined in the Royal Arch of Enoch, Enoch book.
Can you tell us who Enoch is?
Yeah, absolutely. This is where we get into some of the more esoteric doctrines of the book. Enoch is a person mentioned in the book of Genesis. He is one of two biblical patriarchs never to die a physical death. It's him and the prophet Elijah is the other one. These are two more commonly known as the two witnesses to Revelation. If you've been following this new TV show on Sleepy Hollow, on Fox called Sleepy Hollow, you'll know what I'm talking about. But at any rate, in the Bible, the two witnesses to Revelation are Enoch and the prophet Elijah. They never die a physical death. Enoch, at Genesis 5:18-24 is in a nutshell carried off into heaven in corporeal form, and there is a book called the Book of Enoch, which dates to around 350 BCE or BC, dates to the Second Temple period, and what the Book of Enoch describes is what he sees in the afterlife, and he sees some amazing things. He beholds the Tetragrammaton as a source of all wisdom, and he beholds this as the Tree of Life or Hebrew Kabbalah. He interacts with archangels and a group of fallen angels known as the Watchers. He gleans knowledge from these beings, which he ultimately conceals in an underground vault to preserve this wisdom against the deluge of Noah when he returns to Earth. The Book of Enoch describes all these things and what he sees. And from around the 2nd, 3rd century Common Era to around 1773, the Book of Enoch is lost to Western civilization. There are no translations of it. It's off the history pages. It's rediscovered by a Freemason named James Bruce, who returns to Europe with four copies from Ethiopia in 1773. They are deposited in the Bodleian Library, where they remain untranslated until 1821. Bodleian Library is the main library at Oxford University. And it's really not until 1821 that we understand what the Book of Enoch is talking about. What my book presents is this historical anomaly that's going on, where in the 1740s, 1750s, you have this high ceremonial degree, which is part of the original rite of perfection coming out of Paris, France, coming out of the College of Clermont, called the Royal Arch of Enoch. I mean, the ceremonial is named after this guy, where you will have this ritual, its underlying philosophical doctrines or, you know, basis, its symbolism, its philosophy is basically coming straight out of the Book of Enoch. You'll see it in the ritual. You will see it in its underlying philosophy. You will see it in the lessons of the ritual. You will see it in its symbolism of the ritual. You will see astral references in the ritual. You know, this again comes out of the Book of Enoch, which has an astronomy book. And it's clear that this ritual is incorporating elements and components of the Book of Enoch, which should not be happening because technically the book was lost to history until 1821. Yet clearly the creators of this high degree ceremony had access to a copy of this book and clearly had knowledge, higher Kabbalistic knowledge of what this book contained than what was known to Western civilization at the time. And my book documents how this particular high degree is being used within Freemasonry to help define things like the United States of America. You'll see Royal Arch symbology in the Federal District. You'll see solar symbology, you know, when you know how to look for it, both in Blue Lodge Freemasonry and carried forward in this higher degree ceremonial, which is all coming out of the Book of Enoch. And it's this one particular high degree. It's the 13th in the Rite of Perfection. It becomes the 13th degree in the Scottish Rite, and it becomes the 7th degree in the York Rite called the Royal Arch of Enoch. In the York Rite, it's called the Royal Arch of Zorobabel, which is a reference to the Second Temple. And it's clearly containing components of the Book of Enoch. And it's a brand-new historical anomaly, and my book thoroughly documents that.
Why is Enoch so important to Freemasons? It seems like the symbolism in it being the 13th degree has a lot of symbolism just in itself right there.
Right. What you have going on is you have concepts related to Enoch where he beholds the secret name of God, the secret name of deity, which is called the Tetragrammaton. This is carried forward in this Royal Arch degree where in the Blue Lodge, Freemasonry, in the third degree, the name of God, the secret word, the Tetragrammaton, is lost when Hermabith is killed. Hermabith is the builder of Solomon's Temple. He's the architect in charge of it. The third degree Blue Lodge ritual documents his death and the loss of this word. The word is carried, is recovered in the Royal Arch of Enoch degree ceremonial. It's important because, the name Enoch literally means in Hebrew the initiated or the initiate. So we're dealing with, again, doctrines of a person being initiated into these sublime doctrines. Enoch beholds the Tetragrammaton as the source of all wisdom. That comes out of the Book of Enoch. In the high degree ceremonial, the candidate or the Tetragrammaton is recovered. If you understand the underlying philosophical doctrine of this degree, this allows for the restoration of the seven liberal arts and sciences and all mathematical wisdom. In Masonic lore and legend, when Enoch returns to Earth with this knowledge that he's gleaned from the archangels and the watchers, he catches wind that the flood of Noah is coming, and he wants to trick God in a nutshell and preserve this wisdom. So he buries, he inscribes all this knowledge on two pillars, and buries it in this underground vault. And in between these two pillars, one pillar contains the seven liberal arts and sciences, and the other pillar contains wisdom of mathematics. He puts the Tetragrammaton, the secret name of God, which allows for the restoration of this wisdom. And of course, within the Royal Arch ceremonial, the vault of Enoch with this treasure trove is discovered. And in the underlying philosophy of this ritual, the vault had already been breached before the Masons had found it. The Tetragrammaton had been correctly pronounced by a character known as Hermes Mercurius Trismegistus. He restores the seven liberal arts and sciences back to mankind. And of course, the mathematical wisdom is restored by Pythagoras, who breaches the vault, finds the Tetragrammaton, correctly pronounces it, and has his eureka moment, or I have found it, restores the mathematical wisdom contained on the mathematical pillar, namely the 47th proposition of Euclid, which is also known as the Pythagorean theorem. You will find this echoed in Blue Lodge Freemasonry, where the worshipful master's emblem is the Pythagorean theorem or the 47th proposition of Euclid. That's a symbol of Masonic rulership. And, of course, in the fellowcraft degree, in the second degree, the candidate is encouraged to study the seven liberal arts and sciences. This is a reference to Hermes Trismegistus, who in the Royal Arch Ceremonial restores things like rhetoric, philosophy, astronomy back to mankind through the correct pronunciation of the Tetragrammaton. And again, this is the wisdom that Enoch is given to him in the Book of Enoch and brought back down to earth and survives the flood of Noah and is ultimately restored by the Freemasons.
In your book, you explain that there's a Jesuit connection here. It's what, the 13th in the Jesuit-styled Rite of Perfection. Can you explain that?
Yeah, absolutely. What you have going on is we talk about Blue Lodge Freemasonry. This is degrees 1, 2, and 3. This is codified on June 24th, 1717. We know that there were Blue Lodges operating in England in the 1600s, and we know that because there was a man, a real famous antiquarian and lawyer named Elias Ashmole, who joined a Masonic lodge. Ashmole is also affiliated with his proto-Masonic group known as the Rosicrucians. It's mystical Protestantism is what Rosicrucianism is in a nutshell. But we know that there were Masonic lodges operating in England in the 1600s. They're brought together in 1717. And again, this is degrees 1, 2, and 3. What you have happening is Freemasonry really catches hold. It's a unifying force within society that's bringing people of different faiths together. And it's deism, and it's really beginning to get popular. And you have this secret order, or this order working in Europe and England known as the Society of Jesus or the Jesuits. If you do not know, or your listeners are not aware of this, at the Council of Trent, this is after the Protestant Reformation, the Jesuits at the Council of Trent are charged with what is known as the Counter-Reformation. And these guys are put in charge of the Counter-Reformation, and they are essentially using espionage tactics, subterfuge, to assist in the destruction of the Protestant Church, to sway, Protestants back to the Pope in Rome, to infiltrate Protestant organizations and inject it with Roman Catholicism. So the Jesuits, in an effort to take the wheels off of Freemasonry, which is beginning to grow and become real popular, in the 1730s, 1740s, the Society of Jesus creates what is known as the Rite of Perfection. This is being developed at the College of Clermont in Paris, France. This is a Jesuit school, and they're developing these higher degrees as a way to sort of lure Protestants back to the Church, the Catholic Church, the Pope in Rome, and they're using these higher degrees as a way to undermine the English society and the English monarch, and they're trying to use these higher degrees as a vehicle to restore the Stuart side of the Stuart monarchy back to the throne of England, who of course were deposed after the revolution of after Cromwell's dictatorship. Now the Stuarts come back, but they're ultimately deposed with the Glorious Revolution of 1689, where the Catholic side of the Stuarts comes back to the throne, doesn't take well with the English people, and they're thrown off. And the Jesuits are developing these higher degrees as a way to restore the Stuart Catholic side of the family back to the English throne. And the rites take off. They become very popular on the continent of Europe. They don't take off in London so much. And again, we talked about this earlier because of who and what they're associated with. But by the time the high degrees reach the United States of America, it's probably safe to say that the Jesuits are kind of out of the picture at that point in time. The high degrees had sort of taken on a life of its own. They're midwifed piecemeal into this country by a man named Etienne Morin through Haiti. and they are ultimately set up in the 1700s, I want to say in the 1760s. It may have been the late 1750s, I'd have to look, in Albany, New York, by a man named Henry Franken. These 25 degrees, called Henry Franken's Lodge of Perfection. And this lodge ultimately births both the York Rite of Freemasonry and the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. And these 25 degrees, again, are based on the Jesuit high degrees coming out of the College of Clermont in Paris, France. So that's your Jesuit Society of Jesus influence upon Freemasonry. There's much more to it. The book documents a whole lot more. I mean, obviously, you know, we limited time here, but the Royal Arch of Enoch book fully documents the Jesuit influence upon modern-day Freemasonry.
Just to elaborate on that, so basically, in order to make degrees in Freemasonry, they must have had control of Freemasonry at that time to do that.
No, I wouldn't say that. What they're doing is they're perpetuating these higher degrees to lure the Blue Lodge. I wouldn't say they're in control of it. They're in control of the higher degree system, but not necessarily the Blue Lodge. And what they're trying to do is infiltrate the Blue Lodge through these high degrees, get Protestant Masons interested in these higher degree systems, which are have a lot of, if you're familiar with the Scottish Rite and the York Rite, you'll see a lot of Roman Catholic elements in this, without getting too specific. For example, in the York Rite of Freemasonry in the United States ends with the Knights Templars, who have commanderies and encampments. And of course, the Knights Templars were this Roman Catholic warrior monk class in the Middle Ages, who fought in the Holy Lands during the Crusades. And of course, in the Scottish Rite, you will see concepts of, and again, I don't want to get too specific here, but you'll see concepts of a Jesuit-styled confession going on, or vow in the 14th degree in the Scottish Rite. So you will clearly see Jesuit and Catholic elements. I wouldn't say they were in control of Blue Lodge Freemasonry at the time. They were using the higher degrees as a way to try to infiltrate Blue Lodge Freemasonry. The Jesuits in the 1800s, well, more the 1700s, were essentially the Vatican's form of the CIA. They were using espionage tactics, subterfuge, anything, any means necessary to thwart, destroy the Protestant church.
Are they still doing that today?
Pretty much no. It depends on who you want to talk to. The Society of Jesus, like Freemasonry, had a lot of its power undercut from them. The Freemasons lost a lot of their influence with the William Morgan affair of the 1820s, I want to say 1826. Likewise, the Jesuits, their political meddlings, their occultism, their influence really got on the Pope's nerves in 1773, and the Jesuits are suppressed by the Pope in Rome. I've talked about this on other shows. I'll mention it here, and you can ask me about it if you want to go in this line. But the Jesuit order is suppressed in 1773. What happens in 1776? You have this new secret society come on the scene again. That's commingling with Freemasonry, known as Bavarian Illuminati, more commonly known to history as the Illuminati. This is the Illuminati of a man named Adam Weishaupt, formed on May 1st, 1776. I have said on other programs, and I mentioned it in the book, and I stand by this. That the Illuminati of Bavaria, of Adam Weishaupt, was nothing more than the Jesuits under another name. This is confirmed by a Freemason who joined, and a very affluent Freemason who joined the Illuminati by the name of Adolf Knigge. He was a German aristocrat who was very much interested in the democratic ideals, the Pythagorean fire of the Illuminati. When he joins, he gets a whole host of Prussian Freemasons to join. He subsequently leaves the order and writes a treatise saying that I joined the Illuminati to, engage in this sort of, equality fraternity that was espousing equality for all citizens. He said, this is all nonsense. These guys, these Illuminati leaders are all closet Jesuits. This is just the Jesuits under another name. And of course, if you look at the history books, we know that the Jesuits are suppressed in 1773. You have this new group, the Illuminati, come on the scene, and it's the Illuminati that sort of seems to carry the Jesuits through the wars of Napoleon, the French Revolution, and then after the wars of Napoleon are concluded, with his defeat, you have the restoration of the Papal States, the restoration of the Jesuits, and the restoration of the Holy Inquisition. So the Jesuits come back, but they're not one. It's like masonry. A lot of the power, you know, they've been undercut substantially in 1773. They still have influence, but they're not the operators that they once were.
That's interesting. We have a new Jesuit pope. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that is interesting. I wasn't aware. I remember when Francis I was sworn in, they mentioned he was a Jesuit, and they said, oh, well, there must have been another Jesuit pope, and actually there wasn't. He is the first Jesuit pope. It's interesting because you sort of have almost going on simultaneous, you know, right now, and I mentioned this in the book, you have this sort of almost synchronicity going on with the revival of Freemasonry, you know, both Blue Lodge and High Degree going on. You know, we talked about earlier how this esoteric revival seems to be going on right now. And now you almost have, you know, the Jesuits coming back almost in the, you know, being more influential. This comes out of, and this is really interesting that this is going on right now, this is coming out of the works, it seems, of a Christian mystic, a medieval Christian mystic known as Joachim von Fuere. And I mentioned this all over the place in the Royal Arch of Enoch book because he prophesied this new order of the ages that was going to be moderated by these two secret groups, the, you know, secular hermits and spiritual mystics, which have been always defined as the Freemasons and the Jesuits. And, you know, he gets into these concepts of new ages, and, you know, there's an old age of the Father and the age of the Son. He said, but there's going to be this new age coming up. And, of course, I believe, and I mentioned this in the Royal Arch of Enoch book, that this is syncretic of this age of Aquarius that we are now entering into based on the Platonic year, where we are leaving the old age of Pisces behind and entering into this new age of Aquarius, which von Fuere seems to be prophesizing, which is going to be this new age moderated by these two spiritual orders. And here we have this new revival of Freemasonry and the Jesuits at the same time. Just very interesting going on. I mean, you know, is it a coincidence? I don't know. It doesn't seem to be to me at any rate.
Yeah, it doesn't. And there's lots of signs coming out from, you know, the Vatican letting us know that these are those days, possibly, with seems like to be reversing the old days of the Vatican and condemning, you know, capitalism. And every week there's something new that he's coming out that's new, and even with some edicts from the Roman Curia. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. And I know he had just went to Russia, or excuse me, the Russian President Putin just went to visit him yesterday, I believe, which is unique because they would be on the Orthodox side of Christianity and at one time part of the Byzantine Empire. And I know, of course, the East and the West, those two empires have, you know, they've been partners and then they warred together. And one more thing before you go on is this year when the Pope was inaugurated, they had did it in Greek instead of Latin, and that was the first time ever. So this something's huge going on.
Yeah, that's interesting. And also you seem to have sort of, you know, when we get into this concept of the Platonic era and this new age of Aquarius, you have these more, you know, sort of these egalitarian doctrines, and you seem to almost be seeing like a relaxation of some of the more stricter Catholic doctrines. And I say in the book, you know, with this age of Aquarius, I say in the book that you've seen deacons of this for the last 70 years, and the two I identify as women being given the right to vote in this country, and then, of course, most recently, the election of the first African-American president. I believe those are deacons of the coming age of Aquarius. Probably a lot of interesting things are going to happen over the next 50 to 100 years. We know that these ages just don't kickstart and end on a dime. You know, it's a gradual, you know, phase process of one age coming in and one age going out. Usually takes about, you know, there are always, of course, cusp periods when you're dealing with astrological signs, even on the Platonic year. So, you know, if we're leaving Pisces behind and entering Aquarius, you know, it's going to be probably in the next 150 to 200 years, should see some interesting changes coming down the pike, one would think.
Yeah, definitely. So you would think right now your philosophy on our age right now is that we're on that transition where the old is basically transitioning out and the new is transitioning in. And it's kind of like an in tandem kind of thing. It doesn't happen overnight, but actually over decades. And then this would coincide with ages and how they, you know, we're in the year 2013, which is unique because, you know, this is, you know, the Royal Arts degree is the 13th degree. And I know that numbers play a big part in how everything's done. So would you say we're entering into a new age and it just won't be announced till 100 years down the road when someone writes about it? Or
yeah, I think that's right. I think a lot of authors, myself included, have mentioned that, you know, Pisces is coming to an end, you know, and then Aquarius is now starting. You talk about numbers. It's interesting you mention that because in the Royal Arch of Enoch book, you know, if we you know, just backpedal, and, you know, I'm getting a little controversial here, but that's okay. You know, we get to, you know, these astrological ages seem to last 2,000 years, 2,100 years. And, of course, you know, it's called the precession of the equinox because the sun spends 2,000 years in this one sign, moving backwards in the sign 1 degree every 72 years. So the last 2,100 years or so, we've been in the house of Pisces. You know, and, of course, this has been talked about by other, you know, Masonic mystics before, where the age of Pisces is Christianity, you know, where Jesus is the, you know, son, S-U-N instead of S-O-N, you know, and, you know, feeds his followers with the two fishes and washes people's feet because Pisces rules the feet. And, you know, is the virgin birth. Virgo is the opposite house of Pisces and has the 12 apostles, who are the 12 houses of the zodiac. This is the Piscean age of the last 2,000 years. And then, of course, now we're leaving Pisces and entering into Aquarius. And at the one biblical passage on this, and I mentioned this in the Royal Arch of Enoch book, you mentioned numbers, and you know, this is like Kabbalistic, you know, information, concealed number, numerology within the Bible. You actually have this biblical verse where the 12 apostles ask Jesus, if you look at this in an astrological standpoint, it makes sense where, and I'm going to paraphrase the quote, I don't have the quote in front of me right now, but in a nutshell, you have the 12 apostles ask Jesus. This is at Luke 22:10, where the 12 apostles ask Jesus, well, you know, where are you, you know, basically they're asking, where are you going next? And Jesus, being the Son, says, in a nutshell, he said, well, after Pisces is over, he said, you know, you will enter the house of the man carrying the water pitcher, or the earthen pitcher of water. Well, the man carrying the water pitcher is, of course, the sign of Aquarius, which would make sense after Pisces. You know, it moves backwards. So, you know, Aquarius precedes Pisces. So that would be the next house up. And, of course, the number, 2210. The number 2210 contains all the digits of 12, 21, 2012. I mean, they're all right there, you know, which is the end of the Piscean Age, really. It's the December 21st. 2012 countdown, the end of the Mayan calendar, which is the heralding the symbolic end of Pisces and the jump start of Aquarius. So yeah, you get into numbers, very important right there.
What does it signify to us, you know, the common man on the street? Because I believe we're managed by a type of magic, and I'm not sure if you'll elaborate in a little bit after, you know, I talk a little bit about this Enochian magic and symbolism, and that we're possibly managed by this magical system. And you had mentioned that, you know, Jesus had went pretty much from the sun, S-O-N, to being the sun. It's almost as if we went from the age of Gnosis and knowing thyself to a deity outside of us, where we were looking for everything outside of us. And in reality, that's inside of us, is we're, you know, our own pretty much gods, and we could find that true bliss inside of us, as opposed into some religion or some outside being or some planet, you know, a billion miles away.
Well, I think what you're talking about right now, and I tend to agree with you, is you're almost talking the doctrines of Aquarius, where, you know, it's almost like a belief in a supreme being. I've been asked this before. It's like, well, what do you think the religious worship will take form in Aquarius? I said on another program, and I'll say it here, I think it's almost, and I agree with you, I think it's almost the absence of religion. I think it's more deism than an actual religious belief, you know, which we get a little controversial here, but again, I don't really mind. You know, when you get into concepts of religion versus faith, the belief in a supreme being is faith, where the belief about the personality of deity is religion. This would be Christianity, you know, Islam, Judaism. I'm just picking those three because they're the big three. But, you know, even like Buddhism, things like that, and Hinduism. So it, to me, it's almost like with Aquarius, it's almost like, you're right, it's almost like a gnosis where you don't need the external. It's more of a belief in a supreme being, a belief in yourself. Not necessarily that man is God, but man, I think, is more trying to be like God. And I would stress and underscore the word like. But, yeah, you have Aquarius coming up, which to me would seem to be the absence of religion, more of a deistic approach. We've talked about Pisces, which would be the last 2,000 years. This would, of course, be, you know, Jesus, you know, the Piscean fisherman, you know, who turns everyone into the fisher of men. You know, and, of course, Peter is the fisherman who carries forth Christianity after, you know, the crucifixion. I get into all the astral references of the Bible, Old and New Testament, in the Royal Arch of Enoch book. Of course, you know, we get into Jesus being the Son with the 12 apostles who are the 12 houses of the Zodiac. This, of course, is also in the Old Testament where you have Moses would be the Son. Moses would be Aries the Ram. And, of course, the 12 tribes of Israel would be the 12 houses of the Zodiac. That would be pre-Christian. That would be the pre-Christian Aryan age. And then now we have Pisces wrapping up. And, you know, we'd be entering into Aquarius, where I tend to agree with you that you would have sort of this absence of religion, something to that effect. But I don't think you're going to see the real, you know, the real, you know, the quote-unquote age of Aquarius full-blown probably for another 150 to 200 years. So, but you're going to definitely see some interesting changes coming down the pike in the next 50 to 100. That almost seems certain.
Yeah, definitely. And if you study history at the different times where various empires had come into power, it seems like they almost ruled for X amount of years, whether it be a couple hundred or sometimes 500, sometimes a thousand years, and then a new power comes in and the old gods and deities are literally torn down and new ones put up and different things happen. So it seems like that's what's happening now. And with the old Pope Benedict going out and the new Pope right at this time, this is happening where maybe Pope Benedict would be maybe a little bit more flamboyant and materialistic with how he addressed and portrayed himself. And then we have a more humble Pope now with Pope Francis. Kind of, it's just like all right there in front of us.
I think like, I agree with you. It's almost like a kickstart almost to this new, you know, sort of, you know, more democratic, free-thinking age and a relaxation of the doctrines of the old age of Pisces. I think you're beginning to see that now come down the pike, and I agree with you 100%.
What role do you see Russia playing in this? Because, of course, Russia is somewhat of the sleeping, you know, bear up in the north that has only grown in size and power over the last, you know, 50, 100 years, and they're just getting bigger and bigger, and it seems like they're, you see them more in the news, and, you know, President Putin is not only president of the biggest country in the world, he's also president of the G20, and then to top that off, they're doing almost the exact opposite of what America and other countries here in the West and the UK are doing in regards to how they're managing their society. It's more of a Christian-based society, and, you know, they're not caving in to other religions in that country, and, you know, they put a ban on any advertising for abortion. I believe that was today, and, you know, just recently they put a ban on what Putin had said was gay propaganda, because he feels that, you know, if you want to be gay, that's fine, but don't influence other people with that. Where in America, it's like, hey, yeah, everybody, it's no big deal. And it's like the exact opposite, almost like.
Right. Yeah. It's I think Russia, you know, with the end of communism and things like that, you know, you definitely see a loosening of the reins. But again, you know, with things like Russia, China, if we're going to buy into the Aquarian age, then over the next 50 to 100 years, you're going to see the relaxation of these doctrines, of this, you know, hard, stringent, you know, ideological, you know, doctrines, both on the right and left. It's going to be probably more of a, you know, middle of the line sort of thing, middle of the road sort of thing. But again, you know, with Russia and China and, you know, some of these more hardline countries, I think it's more of just a time frame. You know, and again, you know, it's like in this country, you know, you go back, you know, just, you know, we live now in 2013, but if you just go back to, like, you know, less than 100 years ago, up until the mid-1960s, you know, despite the fact that America had fought a civil war, African Americans, up until the 1960s, were all but second-class citizens, especially in the South. And that's no knock. I'm not saying that to be critical or anything, but it wasn't until the Civil Rights Movement. And, you know, here it is, you know, some 50 years later that we have the election of a first, you know, African-American president in this country. So things do move slowly, and, times change. And I think with Russia and China and, you know, some of these hard-line countries, I think the change will come. It just may take a little longer. But again, I want to stress this, that, you know, with these astrological changeovers, it's not the sort of thing that just happens overnight. It never has. It takes for these ages to start and officially end. You know, you're talking a 200 to 300 year time frame. And if we're just right now, which I believe seeing the start of Aquarius again, you're not going to be, into this sign probably for the next 150 to 200 years when you'll be into the full blown, you know, age of Aquarius.
Definitely. And let's get back to the book. And I want to talk a little bit about the symbolism, that being with the Great Seal of the United States, and then also you had mentioned in here also the Seal of California as a Masonic Enochian symbol. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll start with the Great Seal, and then I'll go to the California Seal.
Sure.
Where the Great Seal, of course, this is the it's two-sided. If you want to see this immediately, whip out a $1 bill. The obverse is the one with the eagle. And the reverse is the truncated pyramid with the all-seeing eye on top of it. Again, I get into a whole symbolic analysis of this in the Royal Arch of Enoch book where, and I'm just going to go through this, give you a brief outline of it just because of time, but with the obverse, with the eagle, you will see the number 13 all over the place, the 13 arrows, the 13 berries, the 13 fig leaves, the 13 stripes. This is, of course, exoterically on a more profane level, this number 13 represents the 13 colonies. On an esoteric, more mystical level, this represents this 13th degree, the recovery of the Tetragrammaton, this lost word of a master mason, coming out of the rite of perfection. We know that there is a Scottish rite element to this because the wings on the eagle, one side contains 32 and the other side contains 33. This is, of course, allegorizing the 32nd degree of the Scottish Rite and, of course, the ultimate 33rd degree of the Scottish Rite. So you will definitely see this number 13 reflecting this rite of perfection, Scottish Rite degree symbology of the recovery of the Tetragrammaton, this premier degree. Where the lost word of a master mason is found. Of course, you know, you get into some of the architecture, and I'm just going through this briefly, where the White House sits 13 blocks from the Scottish Rite Temple in Washington. Again, the number 13 is omnipresent. When you get into the other side, the truncated pyramid with the all-seeing eye, we're dealing with Egyptian solar emblems and symbols, where you have the words, thus begins the new order of the ages. You will see the number 13. Embedded in this, and again, the new order of the ages is, of course, what we were just talking about, this new, Aquarian, age, which I believe, and I suggest in the book, that the United States is basically the creation of this, the creation of the United States as this Masonic republic is sort of heralding and announcing this new Aquarian age that is now coming down the pike. You know, that's the motto, thus begins, or thus announcing the new order of the ages, with the, truncated pyramid with the all-seeing eye on top. The eye is, of course, deity, or the eye of providence, which has been used within Freemasonry. The all-seeing eye has been used within Freemasonry on Masonic degree certificates since its inception. So you basically have a reference to this 13th degree, the recovery of the Tetragrammaton, combined with this announcing of this new order of the ages, which to me is this new Aquarian age coming down the pipe. I get into more detail in the Royal Arch of Enoch book, but just briefly, that's what I get into in the book on the symbolic interpretation of the Great Seal. The California Seal is really interesting. What you have going on here is you have the Virgin Goddess of Wisdom, Minerva, appearing on the Seal of California. She is lifted from the seal of Union College of Schenectady, New York, which was the first college set up after the Revolution to offer high degrees in civil engineering or operative masonry. It's too long of a story to get into, but the template of Union College is the sunburst. It's the domed building coming out of the vaulted quadrangle, which is representing the sun or this esoteric wisdom being removed from the Enochian underground vault. That comes off the Royal Arch degree certificate of Benjamin Hurd. And, of course, Minerva is the virgin goddess of wisdom, so she's representing this restoration of this lost wisdom in a Masonic fashion. We know that that's irrefutable because the Minerva is the seal, is the sigil of Union College, and the motto is, we are all now brothers under the laws of Minerva. She is carried forward by a Freemason and an odd fellow named Leland Stanford, who sets up Stanford University in California. And you will see Minerva, and if you want to see the Masonic tie into this, you have to turn to, and it's fully documented in my book, the seal of the first Odd Fellow Lodge in California and the great seal of the Grand Lodge of Odd Fellows in California, which is a seal that ultimately becomes the state seal of California, where you have Minerva on the seal, and then you're going to have these other Enochian royal arch symbols where you have the word Eureka, which is, again, reference to Pythagoras. Esoterically speaking, is a reference to Pythagoras in the Vault of Enoch, restoring the mathematical wisdom by correctly pronouncing the Tetragrammaton, where he restores the 47th proposition of Euclid. That's the it of I have found it of, you know, Eureka. And then you also see the little miner there digging towards the underground vault. You know, esoterically, this is the discovery of the treasure vault, of the person digging towards the hidden treasure vault underneath the holy ground. Exoterically, it's a miner, but esoterically, when you combine it with Minerva, it's a reference to the secret trap door where the Vault of Enoch is discovered on the Temple Mount, and it's symbolizing the digging towards the secret hidden underground Vault of Enoch. And again, you have the word Eureka there and Minerva all confirming this.
Is there any other states that are like the Great Seal and the Seal of California with the Masonic symbolism in them?
Yeah, you've got two that, of course, it's a long story, but of course Pennsylvania is the keystone. This is a reference to Royal Arch Masonry. You can't have a archway without a keystone. And of course, if you know your higher degrees, your Mark Master Mason degree, they find the keystone of Hiram Abiff, and this is, it's through the keystone that ultimately, that spring, it's through this keystone that springs this trap door. The trap door is actually concealed in the keystone, and this is, you know, leads to this underground vault, the Vault of Enoch, concealed under these nine archways. A keystone, without a keystone, an archway can't stand, and of course, a keystone binds all the other stones to it, and of course the symbolism, I get more into it in the Royal Arches, it's Pennsylvania where the Declaration of Independence is created and the Constitution that binds the 13 colonies into one United States, therefore Pennsylvania binds everything together, thus it's the keystone, and of course Texas is the lone star. This is a reference to the Egyptian dog star Sirius, which is the brightest star in the night sky, thus making it the lone star. And, of course, New York is the empire, which is a reference to the Knights Templar and the York Rite of DeWitt Clinton and Thomas Smith Webb. DeWitt Clinton was a former mayor of New York City and governor of New York State. So, yeah, you'll see the sigilism and symbolism on a lot of the state seals, not all of them. You'll see it on some of the stuff, on some of the material and seals of colleges and universities, Enochian symbolism, restoration of knowledge, things like that, Hermes Trismegistus, things of that sort.
Yeah, that's interesting. And then, of course, New York being the financial capital of the world, and there's a connection there with the Templars, and then you have London, and then we have the Statue of Liberty, which also has some Royal Arch Enochian symbolism as well, right?
You have the Statue of Liberty, which is a temple to the number 7, and of course in New York Rite, the Royal Arch ceremonial is the 7th, and the number 7 is, the Statue of Liberty is, for lack of a better word, a temple to the number 7, and of course when you get into New York State also you have the Erie Canal, which is Freemasonry's westward expansion. The entire Erie Canal Lock system is a Royal Arch Masonic icon dedicated to Royal Arch Masonry. When the Erie Canal, it's a long story, I get into it in the book. When the Erie Canal is launched, they actually perform, the Whit Clinton and the Royal Arch Masons actually bless it in a Royal Arch ceremonial. We have a wooden archway over one of the lock systems. The guy behind this is a Royal Arch Mason named Ezra Ames. And you can read all about that in the Royal Arch of Enoch book. I document it much more in depth.
The pentagram as a symbol for Sirius as Isis in the Egyptian pantheon. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. What you have going on there is, this is a reference in Blue Lodge Freemasonry, where you have the candidate portray Hiram Abiff in the Blue Lodge Master Mason ritual, the connection to Isis, the Virgin Mother of the Sun. This is, of course, the wife, sister of Osiris. You have to understand a little bit about what's going on in Blue Lodge Freemasonry, where you have the candidate portrays Hiram Abiff. Make a long story real short, but you have the candidate portrays Hiram Abiff. He's betrayed by three fellow crafts. He's murdered. His body is buried. He's resurrected. In a nutshell, this is a reference to the Osirian cycle, where you have this Egyptian sun god, Osiris. He's murdered. He's resurrected. Osiris is resurrected by his virgin wife, Isis, who possesses the secret word, the secret name of God, of Amun-Re or Ra. What this actual word is, we don't know, but she possessed the secret name of the Egyptian sun god, Amun-Re or Ra. The difference between Osiris and Amun-Re is, in a nutshell, Osiris is sort of the material sun. Amun-Re is the spiritual sun, the esoteric wisdom behind the solar light, as it were. Isis possesses this secret name, and it's through this name that she's able to resurrect Osiris. And with his resurrection, he is born again, and it's through this resurrection that Isis births Horus, this other Egyptian sun god who takes Osiris's place. Osiris goes off to become the solar ruler of the dead, and of course, he's replaced by his solar heir, Horus. In the Greco-Roman mysteries, this is Apollo or Helios. In Blue Lodge Masonry, the candidate is dead as Hiram Abiff. This is Osiris, and we know this because when he's resurrected, he is resurrected on what's called the Five Points of Fellowship. It's a body stance, and when he's resurrected, he has whispered in his ear the substitute word of a master mason. This is a substitute word of God, and of course the five points form a pentagram. There are five points to a pentagram, and if you read Albert Pike, he'll tell you that the pentagram is the Pythagoras of, it represents Pythagoras, but also represents the Egyptian dog star Sirius, which in the Egyptian stellar pantheon is, of course, Isis. So you have this Isis parallel going on, where she possessed the secret name of Amun-Re to resurrect Osiris, and when the candidate's resurrected in the Blue Lodge, he has this secret substitute word whispered in his ear upon the five points, or the pentagram, or Sirius, representing the Virgin Mother Isis, who, of course, births the sun god Horus. And, of course, the story, like the story of Osiris, the story of Hiram Abiff is replete with solar symbolism. Just briefly, Hiram Abiff is dead and resurrected. When he's dead, his body's concealed west of the temple, west representing the setting sun. His body is concealed with what's called a sprig of acacia. That's a flower that grew upon the Nile and is sacred to the sun god Apollo. When he goes missing, King Solomon dispatches 12 fellow craft to go look for his body. The 12 fellow craft are the 12 houses of the zodiac, looking for their lost solar ruler. When Hiram Abiff is resurrected, he's resurrected on what's called the strong grip of a lion's paw. This is a reference to the constellation Leo the Lion, which is the soul house of the sun. So you will see solar references all over Blue Lodge Freemasonry as well.
Yeah, what's interesting to me as well is you have the pentagram, which is, you know, upright, and then you have Osiris, which would be the symbol of Isis you had mentioned, and then Osiris's brother Set, which would be considered Satan, and then you have the Church of Satan, and their symbol is the inverted pentagram. So it's kind of interesting how you have the Church of Satan, which of course materialism and all that excess, do thou wilt, and they use the symbol and they invert it. And then you have the Pythagoreans, which would be their sacred symbol, would be the pentagram.
Right. The pentagram is not necessarily beholden to the Church of Satan. I mean, you know, that pentagram can mean numerous things in different schemas. It's like any symbol. You know, there are usually, if not always, more than one interpretation to it. It can represent the Egyptian dog star Sirius. It can represent the Pythagoras, who referred to the pentagram, you know, as the four points were the four elements, and the mystical fifth element, you know, was mastery of the other four elements. The pentagram can refer to the planet Venus that makes a pentagonal orbit around the sun. It can represent evil. If you invert it with the two points up, you know, then you get into the Church of Satan. This is more a modern day creation of Anton LaVey. But yeah, symbols can mean different things to different people. And, just because one group uses it for one purpose doesn't necessarily, you know, associate it with the other group's purpose for using it.
Yeah, no, I agree. It definitely, there's different, if you study symbolism, there's different interpretations that come down, and it can be used in different ways, and it doesn't mean that they're all interconnected. So, you know, I agree with you there. Okay, let's go ahead and wrap up this interview, Robert. I really appreciate your time. In regards to people that want to find out more about your work, where is the best website to send them to?
Yes, I'll give you my site, and then I'll give you one other lesser one, or another one, I shouldn't say lesser one. You're interested in finding me and buy the book, and you're interested in my work.
Let the brother receive the light.
Masonic history is notoriously difficult to trace. Its origins are shrouded in the mists of time. As multiple streams converge to form a river, so Masonry itself has numerous tributaries. Just like a river, when one follows it back to the source, it virtually disappears, and one arrives at a trickle somewhere, a spring, or runoff from a glacier. Yet somewhere along its course, it undeniably becomes a river, and it is here that our story begins. Masonry and its symbols are an enigma, to which no simple answers may suffice. To quote Albert Pike, the blue degrees are but the outer court, or portico, of the temple. Part of the symbols are displayed there to the initiate, but he is intentionally misled by false interpretations. It is not intended that he shall understand them, but it is intended that he shall imagine he understands them. Their true explication is reserved for the adepts, the princes of Masonry. Another famous Mason, one with unblemished reputation, put it like this: dig through the outer shell and find a meaning. Cut down through that meaning and find another. Under it, if you dig deeply enough, you may find a third, a fourth, who shall say how many teachings. In this video, we will dig for one of these buried teachings and discover a key that unlocks many mysteries, that of the so-called Widow's Son. According to William Harvey, a famous Mason, the outstanding figure in modern Freemasonry is undoubtedly the Widow's Son, who is known to members of the fraternity under the somewhat obscure name of Hiram Abiff. So is Hiram Abiff the iconic Widow's Son? It is true that Master Masons are raised in the image of Hiram Abiff, and many understand this to be the reason they are referred to as Sons of the Widow. Seldom discussed, however, is the question, who is the Widow? Or better yet, who was the Father? What is perhaps the oldest Masonic legend is known as the Legend of the Craft, from which we will now hear a few excerpts, bearing in mind that while nowadays few Masons actually believe this quasi-biblical legend, the early Masons took it quite literally. As Albert Mackey said, this narrative, up to the end of the 17th century, claimed and received the implicit faith of the craft, and, even in the 19th century, has had its advocates among the learned, and its credence among the unlearned of the craft. The Legend of the Craft. How this worthy science was first begun, I shall tell. Before Noah's flood, there was a man named Lamech, as it is written in the fourth chapter of Genesis, whose four children founded the beginning of all crafts in the world. Jubal was the elder son, and he found the craft of geometry. His brother, Jubal, found the craft of music. The third brother, Tubal-Cain, found out smith's craft to work iron and steel, and their sister, Naamah, found out the art of weaving. These children knew well that God would take vengeance for sin, or destroy humanity, either by fire or by water, wherefore they writ the signs they had found in two pillars of stone, that they might be found after Noah's flood. And that one stone was marble, for that would not burn with fire, and that other stone was cleft laterns, a stone that was said to float, and would not drown in no water. The legend then relates that after the flood, Hermes, the father of wise men, he found one of the two pillars of stone, and found the science written there, and he taught it to other men. And at the making of the Tower of Babylon, there was masonry first made much of. And the king of Babylon, Nimrod, was a mason himself, and loved well the science. The legend attributes to Nimrod the creation of masons into an organized body, and he was the first who gave them a constitution or laws for their government. Masonry, according to the legendary account, was founded in Babylon, whence it passed over to the rest of the world, as Abraham and Sarah then brought the seven sciences to the Egyptians, where Euclid became its chief exponent. As for the four children of Lamech, none is more central to Masonry than Tubal-Cain. Tubal-Cain, the celebrated forefather of Masonry, was also the forefather of Hiram Abiff. As his name would imply, he was also a descendant of Cain, for Tubal-Cain means offspring of Cain. So then, according to both the Bible and the Masonic legend, the craft had its origin in the bloodline of Cain. This has always been an open secret, and for some an open wound, both painful and unsightly, so they have attempted to cover it up, going so far as to claim that Lamech was of the line of Seth. Of course, it should be obvious that if Lamech was descended from Seth, he would never have named his child offspring of Cain. Others have claimed the science originated with Adam, who taught it to his sons, and that it was passed on through Seth, not Cain. However, this is contradicted by the original Masonic legend and by the Bible upon which this legend is based. Returning now to Hiram Abiff, we find that there is much dispute as to the origin of the third degree, and the Hiramic legend taught therein. As we shall see, the evidence suggests that these were introduced to the craft by the influence of the Rosicrucians through the instrumentality of Francis Bacon and King James. The Rosicrucian temple legend is quite similar to the Masonic version, but with greater detail and with many important keys not contained in the Hiramic legend, but which are, nonetheless, of the greatest significance to Masonry. Once again, we quote from William Harvey. If the inventors of the third degree got the suggestion from the Rosicrucians to make Hiram the central figure in their new scheme, it is very obvious that they found their details as to his murder in The Legend of the Temple, and turned that story to suit the purpose they had in view. The legend is given at length in Charles William Heckethorn's singularly attractive work, The Secret Societies of All Ages and Countries. In 2004, when Brother Paul Kinney gave a presentation on this legend, he began with the following words. This evening, I would like to present to you a version of the temple legend that few brethren will have heard before. While similar in many respects, it presents challenging differences that, whether correct or not, are nonetheless insightful. He concludes his lecture with the words, the basis of the whole of Freemasonry is to be found in the temple legend concerning Hiram Abiff or Adoniram. Everything to do with the secret of Freemasonry and its tendency is expressed in this temple legend. With this introduction in mind, let us now turn our attention thence. At one point in the legend, as Hiram is attempting to cast his masterwork, the so-called Molten Sea, he finds he has been sabotaged by three jealous apprentices. A disaster occurs, and the unchecked metal flows like lava over the temple floor. As Hiram tries in vain to check the flow with water, a mysterious figure appears above him, saying, come, my son, be without fear. I have rendered thee incombustible. Cast thyself into the flames. The credulous Hiram jumps in, then asks the voice, "Whither do you take me?" The voice answers, "Into the center of the earth, into the soul of the world, into the kingdom of the great Cain, where liberty reigns with him. There the tyrannous envy of Adonai ceases. There can we, despising his anger, taste the fruit of the tree of knowledge. There is the home of my fathers. Who then am I, and who art thou? I am the father of thy fathers. I am the son of Lamech. I am Tubal-Cain." Tubal-Cain introduced Hiram into the sanctuary of fire, where he expounded to him the weakness of Adonai and the base passions of that god, the enemy of his own creature. Hiram was then led into the presence of the author of his race, Cain. Cain related to Hiram his experiences, sufferings, and misfortunes brought upon him by the implacable Adonai. Tubal-Cain then bestowed his hammer to Hiram, saying, "Thanks to this hammer and the help of the genie of fire, thou shalt speedily accomplish the work left unfinished through man's stupidity and malignity." With the help of his newfound ability, Hiram successfully completes his masterpiece, only to be promptly murdered by the same unworthy apprentices. So then, is Cain to be understood as the progenitor of masonry? Not quite. That prize can be awarded to his father, who, according to the legend, is not Adam. We shall now quote from the beginning of the temple legend as given by Steiner. The ancestry of the builders of the mystical temple was as follows. One of the Elohim, or primitive genie, married Eve and had a son called Cain, whilst Jehovah, or Adonai, another of the Elohim, created Adam and united him with Eve to bring forth the family of Abel, to whom were subjected the sons of Cain as punishment for the transgression of Eve. Thus we see that Cain is a direct descendant of the gods, but Abel is a descendant of Adam and Eve, who are human. Cain committed fratricide. He killed Abel, and for this he was excluded from communion with Yahweh. He went away into distant lands and founded his own race there. Adam again united with Eve, and from this union came Seth, also mentioned in the Bible, who took over the role of Abel. Thus we have two generations of mankind, the race of Cain, who was a descendant of Eve and one of the Elohim, and the other race, which had human parentage and was brought into existence at the command of Yahweh. Among the descendants of Cain are all those who have been creators of art and science, as, for instance, Methuselah, the inventor of the Tau script, and Tubal-Cain, who taught the use and working of metal ores and iron. In this line of descent, stemming from the Elohim, were all those who trained themselves in the arts and sciences. Methuselah, another of his descendants, invented the sacred characters, the books of the Tau, and the symbolic T by which the workers descended from the genie of fire recognized each other. Tubal-Cain dug subterranean passages in the mountains to save his race during the deluge, but it perished nevertheless, and only Tubal-Cain and his son came out alive. The wife of Ham, second son of Noah, thought the son of Tubal-Cain handsomer than the sons of men, and he became progenitor of Nimrod, who taught his brethren the art of hunting and founded Babylon. Hiram also descended from the race of Cain, and he was the inheritor of all that had been learned by the others of his line in technology and art. He was the most significant architect we can imagine. Well now, this is all quite interesting, but we still don't know who sired Cain. The legend merely says, one of the Elohim, and that it was not Jehovah. One of the fullest accounts of the legend is to be found in the writings of Max Heindel, in a work entitled Freemasonry and Catholicism, which, despite its simple title, is an important occult document, of which we shall hear but a small fraction. I recommend that interested persons read the article in full, for the doctrine is disfigured by abbreviation. Heindel was a famous Rosicrucian, whose writings, including this one, are often featured on Masonic websites. In Freemasonry and Catholicism, we find a disclaimer which, to the best of my knowledge, does not appear in any of his other works. The writer is not a Mason, and thus he is free to say what he knows without fear of violating obligations. But he is a Mason at heart, and therefore frankly opposed to Catholicism. Before expounding on the Masonic legend, Heindel first details the Rosicrucian creation story, which I have condensed as follows. In the early stages, all was dark and hot. Jehovah, in order to begin the creation of physical life, cooled the newly formed earth with water. Some of the angels adapted well to this change, but other angels, led by Lucifer, could not bear to be quenched with water, so they rebelled against Jehovah. Lucifer led this rebellion, and he, together with his adherents, left the earth to go to Mars. Jehovah's representative angel on earth was Gabriel, while the ambassador of the forces of Lucifer was Samael. According to Heindel, Gabriel's angels are the givers of physical life, while Samael and the hosts of Mars are the angels of death. Despite this, however, Lucifer is cast as the dark hero in the story. For clarity's sake, Heindel explains that the term Catholicism, as here used, does not refer to the Roman Catholic Church alone, Catholic being taken in the sense of universal, so that the term includes all movements inaugurated by the Sons of Set, the priestcraft. Similarly, the term craft is used within this documentary in a broader sense, to be understood as the Cainite movements in general, the Brothers of
the Craft.
I now quote directly from Heindel. The Masonic legend has points of variance from, as well as agreement with, the Bible story. It states that Jehovah created Eve, that the Lucifer spirit, Samael, united with her, but that he was ousted by Jehovah and forced to leave her before the birth of her son, Cain. As he left Eve before the birth of the child, Cain was the son of a widow and a serpent of wisdom. Then Jehovah created Adam, a human being like Eve. Adam and Eve united and begat a child, human like themselves, whose name was Abel. Jehovah, being the lunar god, is associated with water. Hence there was enmity between Cain, the son of fire, and Abel, the son of water. So Cain slew Abel, and Abel was replaced by Seth. In time, and through generations, the sons of Cain became the craftsmen of the world, skilled in the use of fire and metal. Their ideal was male, Hiram Abiff, the master workman. The sons of Seth, on the other hand, became the churchmen, upholding the feminine ideal, the Virgin Mary, and ruling the people by the magic water placed at their temple doors. By arduous and energetic application to the world's work, the sons of Cain have acquired worldly wisdom and temporal power. They have been captains of industry and masters of statecraft, while the sons of Seth, looking to the Lord for guidance, have become the avenue for divine and spiritual wisdom. They constitute the priestcraft. Thus, from the beginning, there have been two kinds of people in the world. One, begotten by the Lucifer spirit Samael, is aggressive, progressive, and possessed of great initiative, but impatient of restraint or authority, whether human or divine. This class is loath to take things on faith, and prone to prove all things by the light of reason. They have lost their spiritual sight, and are imprisoned in the forehead of the body, where it is said Cain was marked. They must wander as prodigal sons, until they find the door of the temple, and ask and receive light. Then, as Freemason, or Children of Light, they are instructed in methods of building a new temple, an ethereal soul body, or house eternal in the heavens, not made with hands and without sound of hammer. When its nakedness is clothed with that house, see Corinthians 4 or 5, then the neophyte receives the Word, the open sesame to the inner worlds, and learns to travel in foreign parts in the invisible worlds. There, he takes soul flights into the heavenly regions and qualifies for higher degrees under the more direct instruction from the grand architect of the universe, who fashioned both heaven and earth. Such is the temperament of the widow's sons, inherited from their divine progenitor Samael,
and given by him to their ancestor, Cain. While Cain, governed by divine ambition, toiled and tilled the soil to make two blades of grass grow where there was only one, Abel, the human progeny of human parents, felt no urge or unrest, himself a creature of Jehovah through Adam and Eve. He was perfectly contented to tend the flocks also created by God, and to accept a livelihood from their divinely begotten increase without labor or exercising initiative. Cain then slew Abel, but did not thereby exterminate the docile creatures of Jehovah. For we are told, Adam knew Eve again, and she bore Seth. Seth had the same characteristics as Abel, and transmitted them to his descendants, who, to this day, continue to trust to the Lord for everything, and who live by faith and not by work. The animosity of Cain and Abel has been perpetuated from generation to generation among their respective descendants. Nor could it be otherwise, because one class, as temporal rulers, aimed to lift humanity to physical well-being through conquest of the material world, while the priesthood, in their role as spiritual guides, urged their followers to forsake the wicked world, the veil of tears, and look to God for comfort. Freemasonry today is an attempt by the hierarchs of fire, the Lucifer spirits, to bring us the imprisoned spirit, light, that by it we may see and know. Catholicism is an activity of the hierarchs of water, and places holy water at the temple door to quench the spirit seeking light and knowledge, and to inculcate faith in Jehovah. Various attempts have been made to unite the two streams of humanity and emancipate them from their progenitors, Jehovah and the Lucifer spirits. With this end in view, the symbolical temple was built according to the instruction of Solomon, the son of Seth, and the molten sea was cast by Hiram Abiff, the son of Cain. But the main object was frustrated, as we have seen, and the attempt at unification proved abortive. In short, the sons of Cain are the originators of the arts and crafts. Therefore, when Jehovah chose Solomon, the scion of the race of Seth, to build a house for his name, Solomon was unable to execute the divine design in concrete form. Therefore, it became necessary for him to apply to King Hiram of Tyre, the descendant of Cain, who selected Hiram Abiff, the son of a widow, as all Freemasons are called because of the relation of their divine progenitor with Eve. Hiram Abiff then became Grand Master of the Army of Construction. In him, the arts and crafts of all the sons of Cain who had gone before had flowered. He was skilled beyond all others in the work of the world, without which the plan of Jehovah must have remained forever a divine dream, and could never have become a concrete reality. The worldly acumen of the sons of Cain was as necessary to the completion of this temple as the spiritual conception of the sons of Seth, and, therefore, during the period of construction, the two classes joined forces, the underlying enmity being hidden under a superficial show of amity. It was, indeed, the first attempt to unite them, and had that been accomplished, the world history from then on would have been altered in a very material manner. In Max Heindel's vision, these two bloodlines will eventually work together in harmony, both ultimately achieving salvation through their respective paths. Other writers were not so utopian, however, as we now return to the standard temple legend as given by Heckethorn and Steiner. Hiram stands in the presence of Cain, there to receive a prophecy. He heard the voice of him who was the offspring of Tubal-Cain and his sister Naamah. A son shall be born unto thee, whom thou shalt indeed not see, but whose numerous descendants shall perpetuate thy race, which, superior to that of Adam, shall acquire the empire of the world. For many centuries they shall consecrate their courage and genius to the service of the ever-ungrateful race of Adam, but at last the best shall become the strongest, and restore on the earth the worship of fire. Thy sons, invincible in thy name, shall destroy the power of kings, the ministers of the Adonai's tyranny. Go, my son, the genii of fire are with thee. The revolution took hold with Martin Luther, whose crest bore a modified rose and cross. Protestantism began, and with it, a serious blow to the spiritual dominance of the Sons of Seth. As Brother Cosgrove said, Washington was a revolutionary of the Brotherhoods that saw the royalties of Holland, France, Germany, Sweden, Italy, and other European countries fall by the sword of the Third Estates. Beginning with the Masonic Reformations of the 16th century, the royalty of Europe bore witness to the hammer of the Sons of Cain, who truly did destroy the power of kings, the ministers of Adonai's, the priesthood's, tyranny. The Russian Revolution was one of the darker chapters in the ongoing struggle. Russia would not merely feel, but even see the hammer, for alongside other symbols more common to the movement, such as the rising sun, its new coat of arms boldly bore the hammer, with which the land was pounded into shape, and the sickle, as harvest time had arrived for that nation. Now, as we read earlier, King Nimrod the Mason began the Tower of Babel, which was also the first major Masonic endeavor. As with Cain, Jehovah did not look with favor upon the tower, and subsequently destroyed it. In a symbolic display of the prophecy expressed in the temple legend, the European Union released a poster with unmistakable imagery showing Masons, or square men, rebuilding the Tower of Babel, symbolizing the EU. To drive this point home, the Parliament building of the EU has also been constructed in a clear imitation of the Tower of Babel. Aside from the implications of centralized government and the re-establishment of Babylon, this symbolizes united rebellion against the will of Jehovah. Before we examine a few other symbols in light of all this information, it is worthwhile to trace the origins of this belief system as far back as may safely be done, where we arrive at certain sects of the Gnostics. Returning to Hecathorn, we read the following. From the Valentinians sprang the Ophites, calling themselves so after the serpent that by tempting Eve brought into the world the blessings of knowledge, and the Cainites, who maintained that Cain had been the first Gnostic, in opposition to the blind, unreasoning faith of Abel, and therefore persecuted by the demiurgist Jehovah. On this idea is founded the Masonic legend of the temple. These Gnostic beliefs eventually found their way into Freemasonry. To quote René Guénon, modern Masonry resulted from a partial fusion of the Brotherhood of the Rose Cross, which had preserved Gnostic doctrine since the Middle Ages, with the ancient building guilds of the Masons, whose tools had moreover already been used as symbols of the Hermetic philosophers. Steve Cosgrove, in his wonderful four-part series, traced the history of the temple legend, uncovering the important fact that handwritten copies were found in the library of Lord Valkyries. This establishes the legend's antiquity, making it by far the most likely source for the Hiramic legend of the Third Degree. Quoting Brother Cosgrove, the Knights Templar revived the idea in the 12th and 13th centuries of building King Solomon's temple, but they were destroyed by the French king, Philip the Fair. Their legacy was preserved on one level by Scottish Freemasonry, and on a higher level by their successors, the Rosicrucians. Scottish Masonry was imported into England when King James VI of Scotland became James I of England in 1603. James can truly be called the Freemason King. After he moved to London and became King of England, he engaged a royal court of Masons. Francis Bacon, the single greatest scientific mind of the time, was his close friend, fellow Mason, and mentor. In the old Scottish ritual system, there was a one-degree ritual, and then after the Second Shaw Statutes, a two-grade degree system that was carried over to England during the reign of King James I. At some time in the early 17th century in the King's Court, the original Scottish two-degree system was modified into a three-degree system, the third degree describing the temple legend of King Solomon, and the building of the temple by Hiram was not always the motif. Most likely, the old charges in both Scotland and England had a one- or two-degree system that had in place a sort of Noah legend, with the pillars of Jachin and Boaz serving as the preservers of the ancient Atlantean wisdom. In the Grand Manuscript from 1726, the manuscript includes an early version of the Hiram legend, in which Noah has the part that after 1730 is ascribed to Hiram. The Rosicrucian contribution to pre-existing initiatic Freemasonry was the supplanting of the temple legend for the old Noah legend based upon the Pillars of Enoch. This temple legend was spread by the Rosicrucian fraternity, first to Germany and Bohemia, then to England, and finally to Scotland, as evidenced by the handwritten translations found in the library of Lord Valkyries. King James VI was an initiated Scottish Mason when he became King of England in 1603. He carried over from Scotland the ancient Masonic rites and made Masonry fashionable in his court and spread its membership throughout England. How the Rosicrucian Third Degree became implanted into the King's court is a mystery, but it is likely that the famous Magus, John Dee, brought it with him when he returned to England from Germany in 1589. His occultism was not acceptable to the King's court, but the King was adorned to another Mason and Rosicrucian, Sir Francis Bacon. It is likely that the new Third Degree was folded into the existing ancient rites brought over from Scotland by Frater Bacon sometime around 1610. By 1630, the first reference to the Masonic word appears in a poem, inextricably bound to Rosicrucian symbol. For we be brethren of the Rosy Cross. We have the Mason's word and second sight. We shall now engage in a bit of speculation, which is not to be considered authoritative, so if you choose to watch this part, please do so indulgently. Let us now consider a few symbols, keeping in mind that all of these symbols have multiple meanings, and most have roots in Egypt. In symbolism, one meaning does not replace another, and even diametrically opposed meanings may be implicit within a single symbol. All we shall do is to examine these symbols in light of the information we have just received, to see if yet another layer of meaning may be added to our repository. Let us also remember that belief systems change over the years, and symbols that mean one thing today may have had very different meanings in times past. We have already touched upon the pillars. In modern Freemasonry, they are exoterically attributed to the Temple of Solomon, although there are many other explanations. One that is most always ignored, however, was apparently one of the earliest, that they represent the twin pillars of knowledge on which the seven sciences were first inscribed. Quoting from Brother Cosgrove, a version of the old charges of Scotland dated back to 1726 refer to a ritual wherein the sons of Noah raised the dead body of Hiram from the grave, looking for a secret connected with the rebuilding of the world after the flood. Also, in these old charges, the two pillars of Boaz and Jachin are not the same as those in the Temple of Solomon. Rather, they are the pillars on which all the esoteric knowledge of the Atlantean age were written in secret script to be preserved for after the deluge of the flood. Incidentally, a biblical scholar named Michael Rood gave a lecture where he demonstrated that the two pillars of Solomon's temple may have actually powered a lever system which operated a trap door behind which the Ark of the Covenant could be concealed in an emergency. This fascinating dissertation is free online, entitled The Great Secret of Solomon's Temple. Tune in at 1 hour and 38 minutes to hear about the pillar system. The apron is declared to be an emblem of innocence. According to Manly Hall, when worn over the area related to the animal passions, the pure lambskin signifies the regeneration of the procreative forces and their consecration to the service of the deity. Though the apron clearly has roots in the old world, there is still a significant correlation in the Book of Genesis. According to Masonic author Dr. J. A. Weiss, the Masonic apron originated from the covering or apron of fig leaves adopted by Adam and Eve after the fall. For after partaking of the forbidden fruit, the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. Thus, we see that the apron might also be said to symbolize the knowledge of good and evil, and, As Hall pointed out, the regeneration of the procreative force resultant from this knowledge. Albert Pike described this force, saying, "It is the instrument of liberty or free will. They, the initiates, represent this force, which presides over the physical generation, under the mythologic and horned form of the god Pan. Thence came the he-goat of the Shabbat, brother of the ancient serpent, and the light-bearer, or Phosphor, of which the poets have made the false Lucifer of the legend." So simply put, the apron can be said to symbolize the occult power of its bearer, and consecration of the serpentine energy for constructive use. It is said that the lodge floor dates back to the Egyptian temples, where it was used to track the passage of time, and the seasons. It is almost certainly connected to the Templars, who used a checkerboard cloth to decipher and thus check their banking obligations in order to square their accounts. Officially, however, we are informed that the mosaic pavement is a representation of the ground floor of King Solomon's temple and is emblematical of human life, checkered with good and evil. More accurately, however, it may be said to symbolize the universe of the knowledge of good and evil, which forms the foundation upon which the initiate stands. The symbolism of the Great Seal of the United States has been the subject of extensive commentary. One detail which seems to have escaped popular notice is the pupil of the all-seeing eye itself. Zooming in, we see that the pupil resembles a flame. But what does this actually mean? There are various interpretations for the eye. It may represent the sun, or eye of the world, also called the eye of Jupiter. For the Egyptians, this role was fulfilled by Horus. Perhaps it simply symbolizes the grand architect of the universe. It may represent the Son of God, who hath his eyes like unto a flame of fire. There is some support for this statement, for the all-seeing eye within a triangle, surrounded by a golden glory, has a Kabbalistic value of 70 plus 3 plus 200, equaling 273, which is the value of the phrase Eben Mosul Habonim, the stone which the builders refused. For others, however, it may also represent that genie of fire, Uncle Samael, who sired Cain and thereby begat the craft. Speaking of America, just how did it get that name anyway? Officially, America is named after the explorer Amerigo Vespucci, but this appears doubtful, like so much of American history, which has transformed a one-time pirate of the family name Griego into an iconic hero named Christopher Columbus. As for America, according to Manly Hall, America is named after the plumed serpent, who is the messenger of the sun. He was the god Quetzalcoatl in Mexico, and in Peru he was called Amaru. From the latter name comes our word America. Amaruca is, literally translated, land of the plumed serpent. As this plumed serpent was a messenger of the sun, he was also a light bearer. The serpent is one of the most enigmatic symbols on earth. It has played a part in religious symbolism throughout the world. Sometimes good, a symbol of wisdom, spirit, and regeneration. Other times, as a symbol of darkness, death, and material power. In some cultures, such as the Hebrew, it is both, symbolizing knowledge and evil, wisdom and death. Christ exhorts us to be wise as serpents, but also guileless as doves. In other words, partake of the serpent's wisdom, but not his nature. Exactly what the founders envisioned when they named America, we may only guess, but perhaps Aleister Crowley can provide us a clue. Casting light on a number of symbols in one very potent paragraph, he said, "This serpent, Satan, is not the enemy of man, but he who made gods of our race, knowing good and evil. He bade, 'Know thyself, and taught initiation. He is the devil of the Book of Thoth, and his emblem is Baphomet, the Androgyne, who is the hieroglyph of arcane perfection. But moreover, his letter is Ion, the eye. He is light, and his zodiacal image is Capricornus, that leaping goat, whose attribute is liberty. Which brings us, at last, to the goat. The goat is one of the most popular Masonic animals, an association which has been the cause of much speculation and controversy. One accusation, which is vehemently denied, is that part of the initiation involves riding a goat. The standard explanation is given in Masonry Defined, which claims it harkens back to the Middle Ages and the belief in the witch orgies, where, it was said, the devil appeared riding on a goat. It was, in England, a common belief that the Freemasons were accustomed in their lodges to raise the devil. So the riding of the goat, which was believed to be practiced by the witches, was transferred to the Freemasons, and the saying remains to this day. This is the explanation most commonly cited by Masonic authorities, who claim that the alleged accusation became an in-joke of sorts, but maintain that the practice was merely a vulgar fantasy. Unfortunately, this is not exactly true, for although evidence is scarce that goat riding formed a part of Masonic ceremony, there were a number of side orders which definitely rode the goat. While such orders did not constitute an official part of Masonry, they were Masonic in the sense that many, such as the Knights of Birmingham, were developed by Masons, and many members, if not the majority, were also Masons. What else is known about the goat? Well, for one thing, the goat was a standard feature in many a lodge of yesteryear. This was revealed by Brother Robert Morris, no less, who mentioned it in passing, saying, "I was riding a donkey a trifle larger than the conventional goat of the Masonic lodge, and my prospects of escaping a drenching and a pelting were solely based on his speed." Such a casual remark reveals this to be common knowledge, at least to the brethren of 1868. To this day, the goat is still present, in some lodges, at least, as attested by the master of the Prince Hall Grand Lodge of Arkansas, who stated, "In my own lodge, some enterprising member brought a live goat to a raising for emphasis, and it made a great impression on the candidates, as well as the members, and more especially me. I thought riding the goat was just a fun part of Masonic initiations, but it caught my attention that night in Little Rock, Arkansas. Moreover, in Turning the Hiram Key, Brother Robert Lomas describes the prelude to his third degree initiation. You've remembered? Sober? Clean underpants? Of course, I said. Is it tonight I really get to ride the goat? You've been listening to Dennis, haven't you? That's a secret, I grinned. Well, David had the cattle trailer behind his Land Rover when he arrived, Mike countered. I hope it's a nanny goat. Of course it's a nanny goat. You aren't thinking you might have to take part in an unnatural act, are you? Well now, enough evidence is on the table to safely ask the question, what can all this represent? Other than the distasteful idea that goat riding is a symbolic imitation of the devil, as the official explanation inadvertently suggests. According to William Moore, the goat, within the context of the lodge room, represented a force that threatened to strip the fraternal initiate of his ability to maintain composure. Indeed, gags, or stunts, were often imposed upon the initiate, largely for the purpose of getting his goat. As an old Shriner publication put it, pomposity is punctured, pride is laughed to scorn, and dignity is bedeviled. If these crafty brothers did not actually invent the practical joke, they certainly perfected it. When the candidate overcame the temptation to react angrily to such treatment, he gained self-control, as people could no longer get his goat. A similar explanation is given by Albert Benjamin, who, in reference to the Egyptian initiation rituals, said, "Such trials, in some form, handed down from this remote period, persist today, as witnessed by the hazing of newcomers at school and the riding of the goat in our lodges.
But why should tests of fitness for initiation be called riding the goat? Zodiacally, the home of Saturn, the origin of our Satan, is Capricorn, pictured in the firmament by a goat. The goat is the symbol of evil, and riding the goat signifies that temptations have been vanquished, the devil overcome, and the animal instincts sublimated into spiritual assets. This is indeed a beautiful explanation, and one that could be readily accepted if riding were the only activity associated with the goat. Picture and poem, however, cast the lodge goat in various other roles, such as brother, or even leader. Some pictures cast the goat in a highly symbolic role, much to the excitement of the brothers. Some detractors have suggested that riding the goat has some sort of sexual connotation. Looking at these pictures and reading such stories as told by Brother Lomas, who truly is to be blamed for such suspicions? So what else can all this symbolize, as the obvious is clearly out of the question?
The goat!
Funny. Now that I come to tell this story to someone else, huh? Don't you find it a bit odd, number three?
Well,
Yes, it is a bit odd, though, isn't it? Yes, it's odd.
Albert Pike already provided us a significant clue when he mentioned that the initiates represent this force which presides over the physical generation under the mythologic and horned form of the god Pan. Thence came the he-goat of the Shabbat. These pictures, then, along with the others, may be interpreted as an initiation of the occult power of generativity, that serpent of the Kundalini. But there are other clues to the goat's identity. In the poem, The Goat, we read that the goat rewards the pursuit of masonry, but punishes one for engaging in worldly things, including prayer. Smoking, however, is apparently condoned, along with alcohol. There was one stunt in particular, entitled Drinking the Goat's Blood. The symbolism behind this is obvious, but there is no need to speculate, for the liner notes of the catalog state that there can be no more appropriate ceremony than serving the candidate with the blood of the animal in order that he might be thoroughly imbued with the spirit and life of the organization. This significant statement brings us to our final interpretation, and it is this. The goat is the motive power upon which its rider travels. And what is this power? It has already been thoroughly elucidated, but to recap, it is associated with Pan, the he-goat, and the ancient serpent, with Phosphor, the light-bearer, yea, Lucifer. In short, the goat may represent Lucifer's agent, Samael, who is intimately associated with the goat. And after all this, none should be surprised that the man who pinned this drawing in 1897 was a Rosicrucian. Interestingly enough, some Masons have actually theorized that the goat symbolizes the scapegoat. If so, this would even be another association with Samael, for Samael is said to be identical with Azazel, the demon to which the so-called scapegoat was sacrificed on Yom Kippur. In truth, this goat was not set free in the wilderness, as many believe. Instead, it was set aside with a scarlet thread for Azazel. Then, after hearing the sins of the people, it was led to the top of a jagged mountain, sacred to Azazel, there to be pushed off the precipice to certain death. Some personalized their identification with Lucifer, such as Shriner Bob Rosland here.
Now, did you just say that you are Lucifer?
I am Lucifer.
Okay, define Lucifer for me.
Pure, virtuous, wholesome, innocent individual that's out to help people.
Lucifer is?
Yeah.
Say that again. Lucifer is a pure, holy...
Virtuous.
Virtuous. Now, see the Lucifer that God created?
That's the same one.
Oh, man, this is great. I'm going to put this on the internet.
Oh,
amen.
God bless you,
amen.
Brother.
Others refer to themselves as goats, while mocking outsiders as sheep. This is highly symbolic, with a correspondence most would agree upon. In Symbolism of the Three Degrees, we read, "The Lamb, as stated in our monitors, has in all ages been deemed an emblem of innocence. It is a familiar saying, and has been for ages, that the lamb shall be separated from the goats. The evil symbolism of the goat is as old as the benignant symbolism of the lamb. In the Bible, sheep and goats are used to denote the two bloodlines, or spiritual types," etc.